Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 259. Okay, I'm good. I'm dyslexic with numbers, by the way, so I am the hero here. I'm struggling. But I'm joined today by Mr. Greg Leahy.
Hoi hoi, everyone.
Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
I'm here.
And who's not here, Mr. John Lindemann. But instead, we're joined today by Mr. Michael Cole.
Hi-de-ho!
The host of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, which...
hasn't happened for a while.
It's not been that long. You put one up there in December.
Yeah, I put up the telethon.
Which is a good episode.
Report. Yeah, it cleaned up very, very nicely, I thought. So
it really did.
If you listen to it live or listen to the version on the RFN feed, it is worth going back and checking out the version on the Radio Trivia feed, because I added background music and all that good stuff. So it's a kind of a
fun episode too. Just it's a nice change of format, because we had a bunch of people on, and weirdly we had the all UK guest crew.
I liked how that worked out. That wasn't entirely coincidental.
Yeah, there was, and I am not kidding, some 5 a.m. scheduling from my phone going on, trying to lock that down. Telethon's a hard thing to get done.
But it's a new calendar year. You know what that means, TYP.
I do need a recording buddy.
Yeah, the list is working its way to completion pretty soon, right, I think.
Hey, maybe we'll tag up after we finish recording this.
Nice.
Or since you'll be a zombie by then, maybe another day.
You presume I'm not already a zombie.
I will say I have an entire episode of just what would be best described as malfeasance of selections. Just monstrous selections that people will just get angry. Be like, these aren't even real songs. Where's this from?
You've been threatening this for years.
Well, yeah,
but I've actually been building it. Like, that's the scary part. Like, there are games that have been kicked out. It's like, no, this is too recognizable. It's like, well, there are ones in there where I listen to it and I'm like, I don't know what this game was. My note says it's this. So that's going to be fun. That's going to be fun. At some point, we'll have to do that. But probably not at the beginning of the year, because I'm trying to resolve to be a better person. But that's going to fail. But first off, it's new business. And as the guest, Mr. Cole.
Yeah, so we'll start with a game that I don't think that we've discussed on this podcast. I don't think it's been discussed on this podcast. It's a game that I've heard in the shadows of internet lore for some time, since I really started doing video game stuff. There have been murmurs of this game in the shadows, and I've never been able to make it much sense of it. This game is Bayou Billy. It's one of these games that like would pop up in trivia questions for Planet Trivia, and you know, I think we used it not too long ago on Radio Trivia. But I knew basically nothing about this game going in. I mean, I hadn't watched videos, so I like, you know, I've heard about this game. I'm just gonna take the plunge. You know, spend the $5. Not a good game. I really don't like this game. I'm not gonna say dislike brawlers. I mean, I have enjoyed a few different brawlers, and you know, over the course of my gaming career, but this one just doesn't feel very good. The brawling mechanics, I feel like it's maybe it's just the NES era, and I'm spoiled or something, but I feel like the enemies land punches and I can't land punches, and I'm not really sure what I'm doing wrong. I don't know if anyone else has played this game. It just comes off as just off. And you know, this is a Konami game, and I also grew up playing the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 brawler for NES, which I feel has much better collision detection and the like. So I guess this is maybe an earlier game. I'm not sure. And then, of course, there's the Zapper elements too, right? And it's kind of fascinating how they've adapted this. So I guess this is one of several Zapper games that they released the same week.
Yeah, they dumped four of them into the wild on the same day.
So with Bayou Billy, for those who don't know, it alternates between these beat 'em up sections, which are kind of like I'd say a poor Final Fight, but I hate Final Fight.
Right.
Like a Kunio-kun fighting game. Like really basic.
Yeah, but with, you know, difficulty in figuring out when you're going to connect. And you have to push both buttons to jump. which I always say. Like, I guess that's
so
not
it's like Double Dragon.
That's some Double Dragon stuff right there.
But anyway, it alternates between those and shooting gallery segments. And so when it shifts between that, the emulator, or you know, in the Wii menu style, it kind of says, "Hey, we're shifting over to Zapper mode. Please hold your controller this other orientation." And then when you're done with that, it the message pops up again, you know, saying, "Hey, now the next section is going to be played in the classic NES controller style."
Does this mean retroactively that Bayou Billy beat Other M to the punch?
Yes. Bayou Billy is the predecessor to Other M.
Yeah, I guess it kind of is, but it's just sort of interesting how they've kind of adapted the emulator to do that. I guess it's smart enough to know when certain, you know, state has been entered in the game.
It's kind of interesting because, I mean, with most of the Zapper games, you know, that's all they are. So you're always going to have the controller out that way. They actually went the extra mile to deal with a game that would have to, you know, you'd have to have the both things.
Exactly. Because I think if you were originally playing this, you'd be switching between player one and player two, right? With player two would be the Zapper and player one.
Right.
Right. But here they had to kind of tweak things. So it's pretty fascinating how they worked around this, but that doesn't change the fact that this game really isn't very good. the Zapper elements are maybe a little better, but even there, I've only played one of the sections. Full disclosure, only played through one of the Zapper sections because it just takes. I have to save state the hell out of this game to get anywhere in the brawler sections. I mean, I thought that was bad when I was playing the second half of Blaster Master, but my God, you know, just complete shameless use of that thing.
Yeah, I mean, this game's difficulty is somewhat infamous.
Yeah, so it's just sort of a bullet sponge, the end boss, and, you know, you're dealing with this helicopter at the same time you're, not end boss, that boss of the level, dealing with the helicopter and these guys shooting out. It just seems unfair, and it also seems, I guess the intent was you're supposed to be shooting where you think that the enemy's going to be, not where they currently are. Right, so, you know, the helicopter's moving, so you actually have to aim further right than where the helicopter currently is, which I guess makes sense, but because they're using a cursor to show you where you're aiming it, there's kind of a cognitive disconnect there, right?
Yeah, because there wouldn't have been a cursor, would there?
Originally it would be like, okay, it'll make sense. You know, the helicopter is so far away, you want to aim, you know, more to the right than it's actually showing on the screen right now.
Do you see your shot going in the distance? Like,
no.
Is there enough feedback?
No, it's just, you know, just like a flash of the screen, like you would see on the original game.
That is terrible.
Yeah. So there's a third mode in this game. I don't know if you've seen it or not. They refer to the game. The tagline for the game was fighting, shooting, racing.
Oh, that's right. There is a I have not gotten to the racing segment because the third level is another brawler and it looks just like the first level, only more annoying. I'm like, okay, I'm done with this game. I've not gotten to the racing yet.
This game was actually called Mad City in Japan. It had nothing to do with the Bayou or anything like that.
Really? Because like the artwork is...
They redid the graphics made the game harder in the West.
Oh, great.
Of course.
Yeah, but... Like, so the plot for this is important because it was so important that A, it showed up in Captain N, and B, they made an Archie comics out of it. You are Billy West, otherwise known as Bayou Billy, a local Crocodile Dundee-like survivalist vigilante and former U.S. soldier from New Orleans, who's fought against the local crime boss known as Godfather Gordon. In retaliation for interfering with the smuggling operations, Gordon kidnaps Billy's girlfriend, Annabelle Lane, in order to lure Billy into one final battle. Billy's quest to save Annabelle consists of 9 stages that take him from the Swamplands to Bourbon Street as he battles Gordon's henchmen and eventually arrives at Gordon's estate for a face-to-face confrontation with the boss himself. What the hell?
That needs to be ROM hacked into the hard target game we never got.
That's just insane.
You know, not highlighted in that synopsis is that I think that they share the same voice.
Oh, that's right. There's voices in this game, isn't there?
Yeah, it goes like, in the cutscene of the bad guy. And then, you know, when Bayou Billy dies, he goes, yeah! But it's pretty sure it's the same person recorded.
I'm watching on YouTube Med City, and it is in the Bayou. So
is
I'm
it?
Not sure where the city is. I guess it's much further on. But the guy is punching alligators.
Yeah.
So. Okay. All right. So I must have seen like a later level. I'm like, that looks like a city. But yeah, I mean, this is, what's your point? This is a 88 game?
Yeah, ultimately? Either 88 or 89.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it's up there in terms of its age. It's not super old for NES. So maybe it's just a bad
It's
game.
Ambitious. I just don't think it's very fun to play.
That's probably ultimately what it came down to. They just tried to do too much. But, you know, if you think about where the market was at that point, you know, there were a ton of brawlers. There were a ton of zapper games. There were a ton of driving games. But they could like, look, we've got all three. And I can see the marketing-driven decision to put together this three-part, it's not a troika, I guess, but this combination of gameplay styles that are all popular, which is like, it's kind of the look, you get three games in one mentality.
Well, yeah, it's kind of the same mentality that started to take over with like 3D platform games, where it's a platform, we got these little mini games here or these side sessions where it becomes like a shooter or, you know, a kind of a racing game or something. So
right.
I think it's kind of a similar appeal there.
You know, I'm looking at this game and I'm just, this has to be inspired by Crocodile Dundee.
Oh, it is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Totally. James in the text that James wrote out. Yeah, it was all in that fever.
Absolutely.
That existed for some bloody reason I've never been able to get my head around.
Oh. I mean, Paul Hogan.
Well, yeah,
is a master on screen. That's why it got around. That movie was like 86. So yeah, totally.
The best thing about that whole thing is the Simpsons Australian episode. that's the only good that came of that.
Are you supposing that Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles isn't worth the price of admission?
Which
I believe came out in 2000.
What?
Oh. I'm dead serious. I remember the ads for that movie.
There is a Crocodile Dundee 3, and I had no idea.
There you go. So this is taking a dark turn down the turnpike of American cinema.
So yeah, let's carry on. You want me to talk about my second game? Or...
I do want you to talk about your second game.
Okay, so the second game I've been playing is Shantae and the Pirate's Curse. So this is a... I think you guys talked about this quite a bit, maybe a year or two ago.
Yep.
But
it got on Johnny's top five.
That does not surprise me.
In the end, Johnny's not been a big fan of WayForward games, so it's kind of a testament
to that. Actually, Johnny and I kind of have similar mentality there. So one reason I'm just now playing this game was because in spite of all the positive press when this game came out, just deep down in the bottom of my gut, I said, I don't like Shantae games.
How many of you have played? Because I've just actually finished this tonight, funnily enough, the final boss. And this was my first Shantae game.
Good.
This is
an excellent game.
I kind of backed off from them before because it's, even though I've played quite a lot of WayForward games and I've enjoyed quite a few of them, although never quite, they're usually more notable for their kind of artistry and their aesthetics, and particularly in sprite work, but also stuff like A Boy and His Blob. That's going to be coming out on the new systems now, isn't it? Like Xbox One and PS4 for some reason. But I enjoyed that and whatnot, but it's usually like the visuals that are the best part of those games. Sometimes the game design is a bit kind of lacking, although like something like Contra 4, they kind of already had the template laid down for them, so I think that they did pretty well with that. But with Shantae, I just kind of hear things like, well, it looks cool and all this, but there's certain aspects of it that you know, not quite up to par, and this was the first one that sounded like it would actually kind of deliver what I was looking for.
Yeah, exactly. So I played the DSi game probably shortly after I got my 3DS, because I didn't own a DSi, so I said, oh, I'll give Shantae a chance, and I did beat that game. But I remember
Risky's Revenge, I think.
Risky's Revenge. I did beat that game, but I remember kind of slogging through it to some extent. It was one of those things like, oh, I just want to see this completion. It has some pacing issues.
It had a confusing map and confusing directions. You didn't really know where you were supposed to go.
And this, it actually reminded me a little bit of Paper Mario and the Thousand Year Door, which some people probably will hate me for saying. But
oh no!
There were segments of that game that I just recall going back and forth through the same corridor in the haunted area like 8 times for no particular reason for the plot. But I digress. Anyway, part of the problem is that I had checked out the Game Boy Color game, and I really, really hate that game. It has some
now
serious
you
levels.
You.
So after playing that, it kind of soured me on Shantae, and so I just sort of put it on the bucket list. I'd heard so much good about it. I said, okay, I'll give it another chance, and it was on sale at the end of last year.
Yeah,
for half price.
It's not a coincidence that we both played this when we have.
Right. So I was going on a road trip and I wanted a game to have. And say, okay, well, this fits the bill. It's half price. And I've been meaning to give this a chance. So I played it. I really like this game. I think they've addressed a lot of the issues with Shantae's previous outings. There was really only one segment that I felt was brought the experience down. And if you know my game taste, you might be able to guess which segment that is. But I'm curious if Greg had a similar experience.
Is it the island with all the purple crap coming out of the ground and all that?
That's annoying too. Yeah,
that was probably my least favorite part of it.
Those enemies are just annoying.
It's interesting because
hard.
Yeah, as a kind of Metroid inspired game to some extent. It's got kind of two different schools of level design in one compared to like some, like the Castlevania games that are in this mold, you know, like because the game split into these discrete islands rather than one contiguous world. You know, each island has kind of the outdoor part, which is big corridors just kind of with enemies, basically. That feels very much like a kind of Igavania type of thing. But then you get the kind of dungeons within that, which have more of a Metroid kind of feel. But because they're more self-contained, there's like one power up in there. There's not like a huge amount of retraversal. So it's kind of, a bit Metroid and a bit like if the Simon's Quest castle sort of levels didn't suck.
Yeah, I'd say it straddles the line between maybe a Metroid game and maybe Zelda 2.
Yeah,
Zelda.
Yeah. You get a down thrust, you know. Clearly in their minds.
At some point, I started to be able to predict, okay, I know what the next power was going to be. Like, okay, I'm going to get the double jump now. Yeah.
Oh, it's like me during the new Star Wars.
Yeah. That I'm bummed. But overall, it's a really well put together package. The segment that I really couldn't stand is the stealth segment. I don't like stealth in games. I can't articulate exactly why, but I just don't like it. Don't like it in my Zelda games. Don't like it in my Shantae games. And like Metal Gear Solid, period.
So stealth has just like a different gameplay reward feedback thing to pretty much every other style of game. You're rewarded for essentially not doing stuff. It's weird. Like, you're doing stuff, and I don't want to sound dismissive of stealth, because I actually like stealth, but you're rewarded for avoiding gameplay mechanics.
Large part of it is that it's very different from the rest of the game. Not necessarily in a good way.
Right. I mean, I'm fine with that in general.
On the topical note, Zero Mission just came out in America Virtual Console. You know, people have issues with the stealth segment in that. It's kind of similar, I think.
It is. I'm sure that's what inspired that segment in this game. But I think Zero Mission pulls it off a little better because, one, it's easier to see where the field of view is for the guys you're supposed to avoid. If I recall correctly, there's like light cones or whatever that...
of a vision cone indicator.
Yeah, and also I think if they spot you, it's really not the end of the world. You can still
Sometimes you might be able to salvage it. I mean, I think if I had a gripe with Zero Mission Stealth Section, it's that it's too long. Yeah. I just think it could use with being a little bit short. I mean, you know, what they were trying to do is because it's a weird kind of arc in that, because it's kind of like when you get to Samus's peak level of power, seemingly her peak power, then you get it all taken away again. And then, rather than that happening in at the start, as is typical in Metroid games that are set later on, it happens towards the end. And then you become even more powerful and demolish everything, and it feels wonderful. But I think that segment went on a little bit too long to get to that sort of cathartic moment. This segment in Shantae is more just squarely in the middle, isn't it? And
it's in the middle. It isn't too long, but
No, I don't. I would say it's too long.
The problem is, whenever you mess up, you get brought back all the way to the beginning, and you have to get pretty darn far before you unlock the means of, you know, an alternate escape, basically. And it just was grueling. I would play, and I get far, and then I was off by one pixel or something, and I guess they saw me this time. Oh, not sure what I did wrong this time. I guess I got to do this all over again for the 20th time. Just how it felt to me, and not a good feeling.
It's a kind of fluff, I think, that bit. You know, they're trying to sort of have fun with the dialogue, the characters, you know, try a bit of comedy and stuff. It just seems like something they put in there to break the game up a bit. But, you know, for me, I guess the one criticism of the Shantae games in general that still kind of rang true as play was like the bullet, well, not necessarily bullet, but, you know, damage absorbency of the enemies at times. It felt like, you know, because of course, yeah, these games, again, Metroid, Castlevania, you know, typically, you know, in Castlevania, you will level up and you might get stronger weapons. In Metroid, you'll get better beams. So, you know, you might have enemies that feel that way for a bit, for a certain moment or passage in the game, but then, you know, eventually you'll kind of come back and you'll be tearing through them. And that doesn't really ever happen with this. Where I mentioned the sort of purple enemies bit, you know, like even when you just go back there to find some extra stuff, you know, was it heart containers or those sort of bats that contain the dark magic, you know, you still find it's kind of awkward to get through there the first, you know, the third or fourth time as you might have done the first time practically. It's just a bit of a slog.
Yeah, I found it was better to just plow through them, almost ignore them and get absorb some damage and just...
Yeah, especially if you
not even try to fight them.
Built up your health, that ends up being like the most expeditious way, which is, you know, again, that's not a huge amount of fun doing that. In other areas, there's some like nice little elements to the level design that help reach reversal, like once you've got a dash, you know, move, you know, you can do that you know, to skip out sections of the level or make it a hell of a lot faster and stuff. So there's some good level design in that area for that kind of backwards-forwards element.
Yeah, agreed.
But the other thing is you do have those power-ups that you can use from the touchscreen that do more you make yourself do more damage, but temporarily I never really got into using them a whole lot. And
I think that's where you can... it can help out. Like, I used a lot the... I think you can have things that hover around you, kind of a shield, these balls damage enemies. I ended up using that way more than I thought I would at the beginning of the game. And it was I don't know, they came in handy. They allowed you to not spend so much time whipping at small enemies and wasting your time.
Yeah, I probably should have used those more. I was wary of using them during boss fights because I thought it might just nerf them altogether. So some of the boss fights probably went on longer than they should have done, longer than they thought they would. But I generally like those, apart from just the odd one felt like, yeah, you know, I've got the idea now. I'm just going to have to repeat it a few more times than I'd like to actually get it done.
Yeah, the final boss is probably the worst defender on that one.
Yeah, yeah. But you kind of, not necessarily expect, but you certainly sort of not surprised when that happens with the final boss.
Right. The only other thing I wanted to mention about this game is that since I was playing on the road trip, basically in the hotel, my wife actually started watching me play, and she really liked the art style. It was kind of surprising. I was just playing, it's like, oh wow, that's really cute. And you know, it got to a point where she got upset with me when I played a segment when she wasn't watching. So it was not really expected, but the art style really grabbed her, and I just thought that I would not have expected this to be a game that would be good for, you know, people watching others play. But
well, 3DS in general can be problematic for other people watching if you've got
The stereoscopic off
right, yeah. No, I mean, it looks great with stereoscopic on, though. It is,
I fiddle with it. I just tend to not play with it on.
I usually do play with it on, but especially having played the Mighty Switch Force games, and, you know, obviously way forward and the pixel art in stereoscopic 3D with the parallax layers and all that. I knew what to expect, and their stuff looks absolutely great. Loads of sort of, character in the, I mean, that was famous even going back to GBC Shantae. It's just how much kind of animation and expressiveness they got out of those sprites, and it certainly, you know, carried through to this.
Yep.
Cool. So, Greg, You and
I've like already split part of TYP's new business. Now you could split part of mine because apart from Shantae, like I just finished it. I've been playing plenty of Mario Maker. Basically, was my number one after all. In fact, I've actually been playing. Yeah, so we're TYP's new level. So why don't we go behind the music here and just hand it back to TYP to talk about how you made these levels.
You're my biggest fan, Greg. I don't have that many people that actually play my levels.
I think I've played.
Thank
them
you
all.
So much for promoting them. It's funny because I don't always know what I'm going to do when I'm working on one of these levels, but. You kind of noodle around until you find something, and then you just sort of run with it. Is what I've found. Other times, I'm aping some old school thing. Like, I had created kind of a Zelda 2 knockoff at one point back in November or December.
Yeah, I remember
and,
this.
Just a couple of days ago, I found this other person who has essentially recreated all the temples from Zelda 2. And then some, and it's like, well, I was thinking of maybe trying to do something more here, but why bother? Just go over here, you know?
It's a nice run in people recreating Castlevania levels, I found. There's one me that's like an eager, clearly an eager lookalike me that's got a
maybe
bunch...
Maybe it's just eager.
I guess it could be. I don't know. Anyway.
Is his name like... Leather Whip or something ridiculous?
No,
like
it is not. It is Ego or something like that. But
Ego,
it could be. But yeah, it's you got quite a few like full Castlevania levels, and then they've got some weird like ways of recreating bosses. Like I can't remember exactly how they did it, but you know, like I think it's the Crazy Legion boss that is like recreated in this bizarre way. You get some funny stuff in that area, but. Yeah, so I've played a few Zelda 2 type stuff, including yours, and I quite like those.
Well, one thing that I found really fascinating when I was playing through, I think his screen handle is like Javi or something, or Jovi. But since we were both pulling from the same source material for at least part of our level, it was just interesting to see how he used different approaches to solve the same problems I was trying to solve. It's almost like, you know, looking how someone else, solves a math equation or a computer algorithm or something where, we're both trying to mimic something like, you know, how you had a key, you know, door to a key there or, a power up here. And in some cases, we do the same thing, you know, in other cases, it's completely different. It's just sort of fascinating to see the kind of divergent evolution, even if you're pulling from the same source material. So it also got me thinking, like, how many times has the same thing been recreated on Mario Maker by different people who don't know each other?
Yeah.
You know, amongst all the different levels that are out there, how many different, you know, Zelda 2 Temple 1 clones are there, you know? I'd just be fascinated to see some of those kinds of metrics, which I don't know if anyone could ever really compile. You mentioned one of my favorites, I think, last time, the Mercedes-Benz.
Oh, it's great.
Blaster Master level. I was trying to be coy. I really wanted Johnny to play that level, Jonathan Metz, and I wanted him to be surprised by it, but I don't think he's played it yet.
He's got to get on that. It's brilliant.
Visually
brilliant. I mean, that is what needed to happen to the Mercedes costume.
As soon as I played that costume level to unlock, I'm like, man, I know what I'm doing now. I don't know how I'm going to pull it off, but I'm going to make this work.
I want to congratulate you in making the first good Blaster Master level.
Oh.
You know, I was going to point out that I think that the indoor section is an improvement over the source
material. It's not saying much.
Not tooting my own horn, just saying.
I don't disagree. I haven't played.
There's a whole lot of fun to be had in that game. There's a whole lot of crap out there too, but more and more I'm finding really fun levels to play, and I'm just surprised at the legs and just having fun building levels, even if almost no one plays
it. You've got over 30 now, I believe.
I'm coming close to that limit, so give me stars if you want me to make more.
Yeah, I've done my best.
I think the fact that people who you know, aren't as invested and aren't as driven by just the joy of making levels have probably dropped off. Like for me, I was always about just playing because I'm terrible at making them. Mine are just be an asshole all the time. Like I think that it's allowed the game levels that are coming through now to be so much more sterling efforts. Like they're just much higher quality because they're people who have been sticking around.
They've probably
really
been honing their craft a little bit.
They have.
And of course using some of the new features as well, which like I think with the checkpoints definitely let you like levels that iterate on concepts more. Without seeming really punitive.
And they also probably been using that comic that Nintendo put out where it's a woman and a pigeon talking about how to make Mario levels. If you haven't seen it, there'll be a link in the show notes. It's a fucking nightmare. But it's actually really good information on like what makes a level good presented in a completely insufferably insane way. So I don't know what to do with this information because I hear you guys talk about this game and I want to go make levels, but every time I make a level, it just turns into a nightmare. It's like, oh, okay, here's a cannon that shoots death. Just constant death. Like, oh, you cleared it? Here's another one right behind it. Gotcha! Oh,
you should play the Bowser level that's got the cannonball. If has anybody else played this, it's like, you know, the Makers bit where they have, like, the woman or the pigeon.
Yes.
Their feed for level. Bowser's feed got a new level where you have to basically keep pace with a cannonball because you're going to need it to jump up right at the end.
Yes.
And that that's some tough stuff, but
there's fun. There was one that people were using the extended cannon. No, I think I talked about this last week. Using the extended cannons.
In the bit that I cut out, yeah.
Oh, okay. Say it again then. Ha! So that they had used the extended cannons all the way up to the top of the screen and put it on tracks, and you had to wall jump back and forth as these things moved, and they were just moving walls. It's like I would have never thought to do that.
That's great. I mean, that was a lot of fun. You know, James, one thing that I feel like I am kind of learning more about level design as I create these things, and I learned a lot just trying to recreate some classic NES levels. I mean, just going through, I literally pull up the video game maps, like GIF of a level layout, and I was kind of using that as stuff. I learned a lot just getting a feel for, okay, that's how, you know, that's how Nintendo put that level together. That, you know, and as you piece it together, you kind of have a better appreciation for why they put it together that way. And I think it's not a bad exercise, you know?
Okay. I think it's just like there's this natural tendency of like, you know, that jump's easy. Maybe if I stretch it out a couple more squares. All right, so
difficulty is very difficult.
You have to jump right when his right foot has just crossed over the threshold. Technically, he's jumping on air, but it's okay. Just don't slow down. And like it's really hard to turn that off. So like I appreciate some of the stuff that's come out recently because I finally got back into it after getting Xenoblade out of my system. It took a while. And I'm just overwhelmed by like, I feel bad because I feel like I missed the community iterating on itself. Like I came in at the end where the community's already sort of reached this new zenith whereas I could have, you know, better appreciated the evolution if I had kept at it. But at the same time, I avoided a lot of crap.
There still is a lot of crap there.
There is.
And unfortunately, there's a level that I've made quite a while ago that's still in limbo because it really doesn't make any sense without the right costume. And I'll be damned if I hunt down any amiibos. So.
Oh, no.
So you're doing
100 Marios to get one.
That's the problem. It's so hard to get the one that I want, and it's so painful because it's one of the ones that you have to do in hard mode.
Oh, is it? Oh, no.
It's just, okay, I went through all this, and what's my reward? Oh, the Wii balance board. Great. That's totally useful for me.
I want to make a level as the Wii balance board.
You know, I think that was one thing that they could have done better. I appreciate that there's a way to unlock these without having the amiibos, but I think that they should have made it a little bit more like, a Smash Brothers game where, let's say, okay, every time you'll earn one random one, but we'll also give you credit towards, say, like, every one out. For every five times you complete this, you have a smash hammer where you can just choose whichever one you want.
Yeah, like the challenge.
I think that would have made things like, so that, even if it's like, oh, well, that wasn't what I wanted, I still feel like I have progress. As it is, it's like, I'm painfully going through every once in a while one of these horrible, horrible levels, a series of levels, and I feel like I just don't get anything out of it at the end. It's like, oh.
Or they could have tied it somehow to the, you know, how many coin stars you get for your own levels. Like, you know, maybe if as you move up those ranks, you can, you know, buy, you know, like it's Smash Brothers. Like, if to extend that analogy, like it gave you another hammer to smash a square or something. You know, just tie them in a little bit, the creating and the playing kind of sides.
Yeah, so as it is, unfortunately, my Sonic-inspired level is just going to have to wait on the shelf. I thought about releasing it, but it's really doesn't... The references won't make any sense.
And the sound effects are really good with it. I've played, people's Sonic's level, so Klex Yoshi, I think, has made some, who listens to the show. I follow his levels, so they're pretty... But a lot of them are good, but the Sonic ones work quite well, even though his proportions look a little weird, but the sound effects are spot on.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Like, I'm finally getting back into it. I'm going to go cruise through some levels of you guys and some of the listeners, and maybe we'll do something cool with levels at some point. We'd kind of wanted to do something a while ago. It just didn't work out.
Well, you did that thing with you and Johnny, the video.
Yeah, we did. And I can't use the cape.
Yeah, we discovered that. I feel like I know more about you now.
I beat Super Mario World not knowing how to use the cape.
Yeah, impressive.
How is that possible?
I don't know.
I mean, I'm pretty bad at doing like the, you know, the boring. I don't know what you call it. But,
yeah.
But yeah, you were really bad.
I did it. Though. I've beaten that game with that skill set. So clearly I am.
I'm going to make like a replica of the last boss of Super Mario World. And if you can't beat that, then you're a fraud, sir. That's...
How are you going to make them?
I don't know. I'll find a way.
Guillaume.
Yes.
You've got something that I in my notes, I just put question marks, even though you told me.
Right. Well, because it's Nintendo, really. I've been mostly playing Xenoblade Chronicles X, and I don't really have any thoughts that I want to share yet. I'm probably going to save them for the spoiler cast that we're going to do in the near future.
Mysterious.
Yeah, well, I'm in Chapter 10. I know that there's still a stretch to go, but I'm
pretty deep.
Well leveled up, and it should be pretty soon.
It stinks!
Well, I know that I've got, right now, an ally. Like, if I were to say that it's a tedious game, I would have at least one person agree with me, right?
You would have at least one person agree with you.
I've
played 40 hours of this game, and it's not that I dislike it, but... I don't know. I'm just not sure game.
Let me give a piece of advice. Give it another 90, and then you'll.
No.
All right. Sorry. You already discussed this game a lot. I don't need to add more to it. But suffice it to say that I probably more aligned with Guillaume in my thoughts of this game. I really love the world design, but and exploring. But there's some things about this game that I just can't get behind.
And so, some stuff I do like about it, but mostly I'm just addicted to the various things, like the leveling up and the stuff like that. And I do want to see the end of the story, but there's so much crap to wait
for
before you get there.
The loot cycle in this game is addictive in frightening ways.
Yeah, anyway, we'll talk more about that in the near future.
Yep.
So because I haven't spent much time with a lot of other stuff that on Nintendo consoles. I have been spending some time with one of the things that I asked Santa for, which is a Steam Link. A few weeks ago, we mentioned the possibility that the NX lived in the cloud, you know, and that perhaps when you've got the portable version of the NX and the home console version of the NX, they interface in some way. They're with their powers combined, they become, you know, more powerful. And
double NX,
and I think that perhaps we got a little bit ahead of ourselves there, you know, because let me tell you that when you deal with Wi-Fi or with wireless, like other norms, other standards than Wi-Fi, but when you deal with wireless and you don't know what's going wrong, but something is going wrong and you don't know what. Like, it's a pain in the ass.
So let's talk about what the Steam Link is quickly.
The Steam Link is this device, basically like a Chromecast or something like that, where it streams the content of your, in this case, computer, you know, through Steam. It streams the audio and video to your TV. So the device is about like the size of, a little bit bigger than a wallet, but very thin, kind of as thick as it needs to be to have like an Ethernet port, you know.
But it's connected to your PC, correct?
It's connected to your TV through HDMI. It's got an Ethernet port. It's got three USB.
I mean, it's interfacing to the game running on your PC.
Yes.
Okay.
So you do need to be running Steam, but you can basically run anything. That's one of the weird things about it. So you launch Steam in big picture mode, and from there you can use the controller to navigate the menus. And if you minimize the screen of Steam big picture, you see your desktop. Like it just streams what your PC monitor is showing. It streams that to the TV. So technically, yeah, you have to go through Steam, but once the connection is established, you can control your PC like on your TV. You know, you can do anything. You could, you know, launch Word and write, I don't know, next great American novel, whatever. So it's a pretty impressive device when it works, and it works mostly when you've got everything wired. So if you've got your PC wired through Ethernet to your router and the Steam Link through Ethernet, then it works pretty damn well. The problem in my case is that I live in a crowded apartment building, and apparently, even though the walls are cement and fireproof and everything, there's some really strong signals that I get from my neighbors, and so it creates interference. And even though my neighbor's Wi-Fi reaches me, apparently my router's Wi-Fi can't get through a very, you know, very simple wall in my own apartment. And so anyway, so I've had Wi-Fi problems, and what it led to is that I had the Steam Link connected through Ethernet to the router, but my laptop was on Wi-Fi, and I had it in the room where I normally podcast, and I can't even say that it was a slideshow, because a slideshow actually, you know, cycles through pictures. I had a static picture of like Tomb Raider anniversary on my piece, on my TV screen, and nothing was happening. And so I moved the laptop to the living room, and yeah, like it was perfectly smooth and normal, and then I put the PC back to the you know, the other room, and nothing works. So I was pretty disappointed, because that was the whole damn point. I could leave my computer where it normally is, you know, in the office area, and I could just play on my TV and everything would go well. But it wasn't working. So I ended up, you know, having to tinker, as you have to do when you're dealing with PC gaming. And so I downloaded an app called Wi-Fi Analyzer on on Karen's phone. So it could show me, okay, so everyone in this building is using like the first channel on their Wi-Fi, so I'm going to use the oven. But that still wasn't enough. Apparently, I will still have to put the laptop on my chair and roll it out in the hallway when I want to play Steam games on TV. But I don't know. I guess it's the price I have to pay for technology and for using Wi-Fi and stuff like that. But all this to say that, yeah, I'm not sure if I believe in the awesome power of the cloud, if the, you know, the smoke machine in my own apartment is not really doing the job. You know, I upgraded my router. It's an Archer C7. It's supposed to be like the best that you can get for that price. And, you know, like it's supposed to be very good for gaming and stuff like that. But it's just, I don't know. Wi-Fi is not, you know, magical. It gets, the signal gets scrambled very easily. And it's, if the NX is using wireless signal to kind of boost its own power and stuff like that, I'm not holding my breath, you know. And I kind of hope that's not the direction that Nintendo has taken.
So You know, we talked about this when it came up. John and I had a little weird side chat where John's like, well, why can't I just use your Wi-Fi? And this is what I pointed to, because I actually pointed back to the gamepad. So the gamepad, Nintendo talks about it. They spent a tremendous amount of time trying to make sure this tech worked, like, bulletproof, because streaming video wirelessly is a pain in the ass.
Yes, it is.
Like, there are devices that you can, like, set up in a conference room to stream a PC to, like, a display TV, and they never work. They're nightmares. There's all kinds of crazy input lag. It's just miserable. So the gamepad working is kind of an amazing thing on its own, but here's the thing. So I bought a house about 2 years ago, and the gamepad has worked flawlessly. Prior to that, I lived in an apartment, and the gamepad was a nightmare all the time, constantly losing its signal. Like, I couldn't go to my – I mean, I had a galley kitchen attached to my living room. I couldn't go into the kitchen and it not lose signal. But – which, like, there's not – you were talking about a wall. There's literally no wall. It is me moving through space. But in the house, I've taken it all the way upstairs with Netflix to, like, get something out of my office and gone back down.
Mm-hmm.
So – there's definitely, like, a real challenge here to making this kind of thing work, and I think the answer would have to be that you're not trying to use Wi-Fi.
Right.
You'd have to be trying to connect directly, but even then, as I mentioned, that there's all kinds of goofiness that can happen with just, like, the gamepad if you're dealing in a Wi-Fi hot zone.
Right.
So not to get too technical, you have to start thinking about what kind of frequency a device like this would be allowed to use by, like, the FCC. Like,
Right, they can't. Their options are tied. I mean, they're limited options for this because everyone's using the same narrow spectrum.
Right, they can't just go shooting out on like the 2 gigahertz band where your wireless phones work. The FCC would rip their neck open and then climb down it. Like there's like really hard rules about this stuff, and unfortunately, this kind of device would probably end up in the Wi-Fi spectrum,
right.
Which is a problem because that is. Probably, I would guess at this point, one of the noisiest pieces of spectrum there is short of the cell phone band. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you get around it. And that's such a weird technical challenge that, I mean, it's totally human created. We pinned ourselves into these bands. We created these buckets for a reason. Because if you don't do that, it's just chaos. But it does mean that if you're trying to come up with something really new and different and using a band in a way that it wasn't like super designed for, you get weird and bad behavior. And I would say that this, you know, what you were seeing is kind of an example of that. It's not, you know, it's broadcasting screen and button inputs over the internet with an unacceptable amount of button lag. Like, if you think about games that you would play on a Steamcast device, like, it can't have any kind of meaningful input lag unless you're playing a game that doesn't care. So if you're playing like an action game, if you're playing like, I don't know, the Devil May Cry collection that came out not that long ago on Steam, like you can't do it because if there's any input lag whatsoever, you'll just fail constantly. So that's what makes it amazing that I could play Bayo 2 on the gamepad. But if I guarantee you, I couldn't have played it in my apartment. And I have to imagine if Nintendo was thinking about this as a core feature of their platform, they would think about that. But
well, you got to think as well, Nintendo would be very sensitive to apartment living and sort of densely clustered people because of Japan. I mean, they are, we always say about how Japan-centric they are, and surely that is how so many people live in Japan. But I can't imagine the next platform being dependent on, you know, some sort of environment that simply wouldn't really work in Japan.
Yeah, agreed.
But I'm a little surprised about the gamepad, though. Like, I was convinced...
Yeah, I think that's somewhat of a surprise, but I guess it is still, you know, somewhat workable in general. Not so much like taking it into other rooms, but, you know, just...
It would lose connection right next to the device sometimes.
Well, like, but
really? Good lord.
Yeah. The other piece of this, though, is that in most cases, I'm not going to say in all cases, but in a lot of cases, the gamepad is either for off-screen plays, so it's not... critical, you could still play the game,
right?
If you weren't using the gamepad, or it's, you know, menus or something for, you know, even if there's a little bit of lag or choppiness, in theory, you might be able to get away with it. So that's probably why, for the purpose of the gamepad, they were willing to take that risk,
right?
And release this. If you're talking something more like this Chromecast, but the Steam streaming type thing, where just this is how you play, I don't think they're going to do that for just the reasons we're citing here. It isn't a halfway house there. It's robust enough that, you know, you could still enjoy the game even if that's not quite working for you.
The one way you could fake it, or not fake it, the one way you could sort of mitigate the natural noise, because, I mean, regardless of how great you engineer it, there's going to be noise problems. Like,
yeah.
There just is. The way you'd have to mitigate it, you have to design how the game does processing so that the stuff it's pushing off, it can just lose that briefly and be okay. The gamepad, if it loses connection, a lot of times the game just goes into like a holding pattern until the gamepad gets connected again.
Mario Maker pauses instantly. For instance.
So if you could engineer, you'd have to engineer the game code. So every game would have to be built with this in mind, that the stuff it's shooting off. Yeah, I mean it's really hard. Like you're deep into computer science stuff at this point, and that's
and no matter how well engineered it's been, like there's always like you don't know what conditions people are gonna play this device in, you know. And
imagine trying it at E3. Like it'd be a nightmare.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They would have them tethered for sure. But just to give you an idea, like in this case, like the Steam Link was fairly easy to troubleshoot because I could visualize, okay, like I see here all my neighbors' Wi-Fi and I see what channels they are, and I could, you know, okay, I switch this and okay, well, the wall is still a problem. So anyway, so I managed to solve the problem, but when the WaveBird came out, I moved in with some new roommates, and there was this roommate who kept his PC without the case on in the living room. And he would, like, tried to play the GameCube a few times, and, like, he would not, he was like, this sucks, you know, this loses connection, doesn't work very well. And I couldn't figure out why all of a sudden my WaveBird wasn't working anymore until I realized, oh, it's the fucking PC kind of emitting radiation or whatever. Like, once he put the case back on, the WaveBird started working again. It's like, well, like, you're not going to send a freaking engineer at every people's house who say they have a problem, right? Like, how would you know that that's the culprit?
Well, and so, I would say in your case, you already showed a tremendous degree of power user stuff by even understanding that Wi-Fi has channels and acting on that information.
Most people don't even bother changing it. Like, I could see it. Like, all my neighbors, they're all around, like, they're all in channel one because.
Right. I mean, I'm probably bothered. I haven't bothered since I got my new router, but I live in a house, so it's not a big deal. In the apartment, I had to change it because it was, to your point, it defaulted on one and that was a disaster. Mm-hmm. Day of crisis. Anyway, we're going to wrap this segment up with my new business. First off, I'm going to talk about a game that's not really a big deal. Came out on the Wii U eShop called Fast Racing Neo from Shining Games. The dig didn't even get any kind of response. That's kind of painful.
I don't know. Sometimes with you, James. You know, it could be deadpanning or it could be, you know, just actually earnestly straight.
Right. Yeah. I still haven't downloaded it.
Yeah, that's fair.
No, me neither.
I haven't checked it out yet.
So I haven't played it since the minimap update came out. Like, it was yesterday. I have a job, people. I'm sorry, God. But I want to talk a little bit about punishment reward kind of balance. And this has come up on the show a couple times, and I mentioned it kind of.
The sin of punishment's come up quite a lot of time.
It has. You're right. And I mentioned this when we were discussing Game of the Year stuff. So I'm not gonna spend a lot of time talking about this game. Mechanically, I think this game works really. It feels really good. The sense of speed is really impressive. It's visually very, very nice. I think maybe it's trying a little too hard to tread some of the like futuristic racing, you know, checkboxes. The color switching thing is nice. It just, you know, maybe trying for their own style a little bit more would have been cool, but beyond that, it's fine. It looks really nice. My problem is how the game handles punishment reward, which is to say, if you crash, how much is it going to cost you? And if you play well, like, what is your reward? So, in the single player game where you unlock cups and you unlock carts, you do it by essentially you complete a tournament in the top three, you unlock a car, and in the next tournament, and then you unlock all the tournaments, you unlock the next difficulty level. This continues until you've unlocked everything. The trick is the computer is very competitive. There's a couple racers that they'll have that are going to consistently fight for the top few slots. They don't tend to have a situation where, like, this guy's going to get first place on every single race unless you get it. That's kind of an F-Zero thing that came up every so often. But generally speaking, the top four or five are the top four and five in every race, which means you have to be very competitive to get a top three finish. You know, you have to rank well. You either have to really knock it out of the park and get first place on two or three races, or you have to be in that top four or so every single race to get a top three finish.
This sounds just like F-Zero GX to me, so far.
That is very similar to F-Zero GX, and that's not the problem. I'm okay with that. So what's funny is the game is really, really fast. I mean, it's in the name, but it's race laps are incredibly quick. Like, they are over very quick. Races are frequently sub 6 minutes. So if you wreck, F-Zero GX, you wrecked, you had to restart the race. Like, that was done. You had a limited number of continues per tournament, and you're out. This game just sort of sets you back, kind of Mario Kart style, but it sets you back pretty far. And it doesn't always.
Well, that's the thing. With Mario Kart, there are mechanisms to get back up the field.
Right.
You know, that I can't imagine a game sort of attempted to be in the vein of F-Zero would have.
And it doesn't. So, if. You can slowly climb back in it. Like, if you wreck in the first lap, you can probably get back to third or fourth. But if you wreck in the third lap, I mean, you're done. I wrecked once, so I had to get fifth or better to clear. I always do the math in my head where I need to be. I need to get fifth or better. And I was trending at third. Like, I was kind of in a fight between for second, third, or fourth. Like, we were all kind of bunched up together. I wrecked, and when the game reset me, I was in 10th. And I had no chance to get back. I boosted the whole way through, and it didn't really make a big difference. I think the game refills your boost, but I know this is where the joking refrain of get good goes, but there's a part there of
It would actually be preferable to restart, begs the question, is that something you could do quickly, easily, at all?
There's no restart. That's the problem. It's not that the game drops you back. It's that I can't restart the race. So I knew at that point, once I wrecked, there was no point in finishing this race because I wasn't going to get third or better in the tournament. So I wasn't going to get to advance. So I just quit all the way back to the menu. And then the last 15 minutes was just gone.
Yeah, that's bad design.
I mean, 15 minutes where I had actually raced pretty well. This is deep into the game at this point. And fighting for a top three finish is hard in the upper difficulty levels. Like, you really got to fight, and I mean, everything matters. You've got to get a good start. You really can't scrape the sides. You have to be good at doing the color switching to hit all the boost pads. You have to make smart use of your boosting to get through hazards, and you most importantly cannot crash, like, period. So it is a real bummer when I've been fighting really hard to play really well and I can't restart. Now, I understand if you limit the number of restarts. It's a four-race tournament, so you could say two restarts.
Mm.
You get to be selective. Like, okay, I can't just bail on this when I don't get a hot start out of the gate. Like, I have to really be, you know, like, I have to really look at the situation and go, I need to restart this race. But to know with the full lap to go that this entire exercise is now pointless is really frustrating. So...
Well, I think it's refreshing that they found a way to show us that F-Zero GX was more forgiving than we thought.
I know. It was kind of a funny thought when I had it. I thought, well, that's just a terrible thing to think. Now, with the minimap, I haven't seen it. I struggle to know how it would make the hazards more helpful because, for example, there's a stage where there's a big giant mechanoid spider and its feet just stomp around the track. So the minimap can't tell you where its feet are, I don't think. So, like, It's really easy to come around that turn right as he's putting his foot down and you not realize that's where it's going to be and you're done. So there's a lot going on in this game in terms of making it, you know, in terms of difficulty, which is fine. Like, I'm okay with that, but God, I need a restart. Like, if this game had a restart, I would be in it all the time. Even if it was a limited restart. It's nothing makes me quit the game faster than that kind of scenario where, like, I was trending to get first in this tournament, and now maybe I'm going to get third, but it's like, well, I guess I'll just finish it, and then I'll turn it off. Like, pretty much every time I've turned the game off is when this happens, and that's a bummer, because otherwise I'm having a lot of fun with it. So, I want to talk about one more game, and I think this is probably the most important game to come out on 3DS in the last ever. It's Johnny's Payday Panic for the 3DS eShop. So, if you have somehow missed this hot banger of a video game.
Yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about right now, James.
It is an incredibly Japanese game where you play as a cheap anime drawn high schooler, but it's like the whole game is represented in color manga form. So it's like these kind of still images with text, with just completely absurdist text on them. And basically, Johnny wants to be a big shot. That's his goal in life. He wants to be a big shot. And he was coming around the corner one day, and he saw a guy in a leather biker jacket with a multi-story tall pompadour. And he thought, wow, I want to be that big shot right there. And that big shot, with all the girls and guys around him, just celebrating his big shotness, dropped these cards. Johnny picked them up, and they were just things that if he could get them, if he could buy this motorcycle, that jacket, that watch, he too could be a big shot. So Johnny needs to take a part-time job to be a big shot. And those part-time jobs mean making ice cream, making burgers, serving like shawarma. Basically, it's cook-serve delicious on the 3DS, but wrapped in this completely stupid, amazing Japanese, like, concept of just nonsense. It's...
So, does Suda 51 have any...
No, like, it's way
he's
too...
not in the credits?
No. No, it's way too upbeat for him. Like, it's just... So, here's a good example. I am playing the game right now. I'm pretty deep into the game, because it's essentially just, like, a minute-long mini-game of you serving food to customers. And then you get your pay, and you're basically trying to save up money for different things. So, after you buy an item, you're presented with four cards. Some of them may be turned over if you've already gotten them. You pick one, it flips over, and you're given sort of the silhouette for what the item is, the amount, and then Johnny going, "With this, I will be a big shot." And then, like, he's got like fire coming up behind him as he strikes this like pose where he's charging up his power. And then you go and you do stuff to earn money. So, for example, I'm really good at serving ice cream. And as I've served ice cream, I've leveled up my ice cream serving based on my performance. And I get new bonuses. Like, the first bonus is your shift is longer, so you can go more. Then it's, you know, you get double take-home pay. Then it's you get a button that automatically takes out the right serving implements, like a cone or a cup. So the person comes up to the window, you press the button, it shows up on the screen already. You don't have to go down to the bottom of the screen and dig out the one you're looking for. As I leveled it up, eventually got to the point where they wouldn't care if I gave them their ice cream flavors in the wrong order. So if they wanted two scoops, strawberry and vanilla and strawberry would be okay, except for this one guy where the game warns, look out for this guy, it still matters to him. And then eventually I got things like it would tell me the ice cream on the ice cream dispenser. So I'd hit the guy, it'd put his serving thing down there, and then it would light up little icons I would tap on the ice cream bucket, so I did them in the right order. And I've gotten really fast where I'm serving like 60 people in a shift, just hammering through it. Some of them, like, there are certain characters you recognize, like the businessman, who he's very impatient, and he usually gives you a big order. So you have to like work the lines. You have like a queue of four people. Maybe he has to jump ahead. They have the big fat woman who's also very impatient, but her orders are also usually obscenely large. So you have to kind of manage her stuff, because it's gonna take more time to make hers. So if those two show up at the same time, you have to figure out, okay, she needs to go first. Yeah, it's kind of remarkably fun. Like, it's not smart. It's not particularly complicated, but like, the progression system, like, I'm always engaged in, all right, I'm about to level up for my good performance. What am I going to get next? And you can level down by screwing up or by not going to a job for a while. Like, a boss will call you and that's your warning. You need to go work that place. And sometimes you get rush hour, which is just way too much money. I made 2.7 million yen serving ice cream yesterday. I mean, that's some good money for a single take-home pay. I'm saving up 50 million yen so I can buy a stretch limousine, because I'm going to be a big shot. The best, though, when he gets it, is he strikes that pose again with his hands just full of yen. Like, they've made no effort to make these look like dollars. They fly out of his hands into the sky, and then the item drops down in front of him. The background turns to flower petals, and then, like, puppets on a stick of girls celebrating in front of him come out in front of him and just dance. And then he goes, now I'm a big shot. And then you need to get the next item. And the items are just increasing in their just absurdity as I go. So originally it was like, I need these sunglasses. Now I'm saving up 500 million yen for something. I don't even know what it is. But I'm excited to find out, because this game is stupid. Like, I legitimately enjoy this game being dumb. And it's dirt cheap. Like, it's not, I wouldn't call it a great game, but it's funny, and I've had fun with it, and the minigames are actually pretty decent. There's a certain degree of, like, if you're making burgers, you have to manage the burgers you have on the grill, you have to get drinks, you have to manage the drink dispenser, and you have to manage people you've got in line. So you have to know, this guy came first, this guy came second, so I need to serve him first, but that guy needs to be served quicker. There's actually some complexity here. It's not sitting in the hot tub to make money so you can buy your limousine. It's serving ice cream all day long and coming home with more yen than the prime minister makes in a year.
A crucial distinction.
Crucial. Like, it's actually decently skill-based. Like, you really have to start thinking about stuff, and as you unlock these sort of helpers, the game starts hitting you with faster requests, and you have to manage more in your head. So the mechanics are somewhat calmed down, but then the actual mental gymnastics become more involved. It's actually remarkably rewarding to play, and I actually really enjoy some of the minigames. Like, the making the cupcakes one is actually kind of like crazy and frenetic, that I've kind of gotten to the point where I'm really good at it, and I just kind of enjoy doing it. So yeah, it's not great. It's a pretty shallow game, but it's wrapped in this wrapper of just candy-coated chaos that I really enjoy. At the very least, you should go watch a YouTube video of this game. It is something else to see. And on that, we're going to take a break. Welcome back. It's time for listener mail. It's been a while since we've done one of these. We did one at the last episode of December, I believe. So it's been about a month at this point, which is crazy. We haven't done listener mail in that long. It's kind of nuts. So if we didn't get to your email, I apologize. Some of the emails have gotten kind of stale just because they were about current events, and maybe we've passed on them just because we didn't get them in a timely manner. That's on us. I apologize. But if you want us to read your email, and I know that I just really hyped up your prospects here, but if you send an email, there's a pretty good chance we're going to use it on the show, because we're not going to be taking like 4 weeks of consecutive non-emails for a while. So you can send your email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. As always, I will say it again at the end of the show. First email, Mike.
All right. GX writes, "Dear RFN crew," that's you guys, "with Smash DLC coming to a close, and NX looming on a distant hill, I can't help but look back at the Wii U's lifespan. Within the last 2 years, we've seen the release of four games that stand as some of the console's strongest pillars: Mario Kart, Smash Brothers, Splatoon, and Mario Maker, all with significant online multiplayer or sharing features. I still go back to these games frequently, to the point where I wonder, what are the future of these games? There is so much content in each of these that I really don't want to see them start over at square one when or if they come to the next console. How would you feel if Nintendo fast-tracked these games closer to the next console's launch by practically porting them as a platform rather than a sequel, but adding significant content to them?"
I think we could talk about it there. He's got more stuff, but yeah. I mean, I think we'll probably touch on a lot of these as we go.
I think it's exactly what they should do, and hopefully it is what they're going to do.
Well, it's certainly what platform holders have been doing with new platforms in recent times.
I don't know. It feels to me like we're getting a little bit close to kind of what's occurring a little bit everywhere else in the AAA field annualizing, certain franchises. And do I want to see kind of Assassin's Creed type improvements in these things? Like, I'm not sure I do.
So I don't view this as an Assassin's Creed scenario. This is more of the HD remake scenario. This is more of like Devil May Cry 4 Ultra Deluxe Edition scenario, where they've just created they go back to the game and they make some fidelity updates, they make some adaptions for whatever the platform change that they have to deal with, and then just release it for that platform as well. Or release it for the new platform. It's not a sequel. It's not like the annualized sequelitis. It's the same game. It's just maybe an enhanced version of that game, maybe some more content added.
Yeah. Now, what I'd like to see, and I don't know if this is what, the way Nintendo would go or not, but what I would like to see is something along the lines of almost like what they do with the Virtual Console, where if you owned it in the previous generation, you can pay a modest fee for it to be, you know, upgraded, or maybe even, you know, let it go for free. It depends on kind of what their approach is. If it's easy enough for them to recompile or whatever these Wii U games and say, hey, day one, we have all these other games from the Wii U library on the eShop, day one for NX. And
it would depend on how much they add, too.
It's the same platform, basically. It depends on, you know, if they're using similar architecture or have a method for doing that. But I could see a scenario where they're basically saying, you know what, all those games, or at least the ones that don't rely too heavily on the gamepad, we can, you know, just keep playing it like you were playing on the Wii U. Now you can do it on NX.
Well, a big thing about that would be carrying over your save stuff, wouldn't it? I mean, yeah. Because you think of something like a Smash Brothers, Mario Kart to some extent, you know, unlocking things or that kind of, you know, you're not going to want to do that again. If it, mm-hmm. you know, if you're going to get people to take the plunge, it's like, okay, well, you know, I'll pay however much money it takes to have some kind of upgrades, and it's on the new system, which I'm going to be using presumably for some original content. You know, I mean, I think you need a mix. Even though in recent times I can't really name that many launches that look that appetizing to me, but you know, sometimes those launches struggle and then other times they do very well. I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, the Wii was brimming with stuff at launch, but yeah, Wii Sports was such a big deal that it ended up being a successful launch. I don't know whether just looking at it you would have thought that in terms of the volume of or diversity of content. I mean, it's very difficult sometimes to predict or to capture exactly how something kind of just sparks off.
Well, we had Far Cry Vengeance, so obviously the most important launch game of any platform ever.
I know. Launches in general just don't seem that great to me a lot of the time.
No, you know? They aren't. I mean, you're buying promise.
And a lot of the time you need these sorts of things that we're talking about here, you know, where you might, you know, sort of repackage an existing thing with some upgrades and stuff to really, you know, get any kind of substantial content at all. I mean, I think it's a pretty safe bet that you might see them extend some of these games over. But like I said, I think it's important, you know, for people who've built up a sort of loadout in Splatoon, or they've unlocked all this stuff in Smash Brothers, or, you know, got all the trophies or something, that, you know, it's not like you're paying to go back to square one. Yeah, I mean, you know, if it's going to feel like it's got some sense of continuity. You know, I think it would be important to find. I don't know if there's any way they could do that through the Nintendo Network and subsequent My Nintendo account, whatever, you know, the integration that's coming.
Why I'm hoping that it really is basically, okay, you already own the game. It's just sort of like backwards compatibility, but it's not even that it's backwards compatibility. Like, this game is also on this platform. You already own this game. I mean, that would be a somewhat different paradigm from this whole, well, you got to buy the game twice if you want it on 3DS and Wii U, which is kind of what we run into here. But Nintendo's made noises suggesting that they're trying to get away from that. What we've been seeing about the Virtual Console, where they're not really doing much on 3DS. They seem to be focusing on, even for portable games, releasing them on the console. To me, that all points towards this sort of unified platform that's, if not Power PC based, is something that they figured out. You know, they have something in the background that is compatible with Power PC and x86, whatever architecture to go with the NX. I don't know, but I just have to think that behind the scenes they're thinking about this stuff. Especially part of the good news is, like this email points out, Nintendo has more skin in the game now to some extent with some of this stuff, especially like you said with these save files. They have first-party games where they know that people don't really want to have to start over, right? I mean, they have Splatoon. Mario Maker, maybe not as big a deal, but something like Splatoon, absolutely. You can't just start over. And I think they're going to be cognizant of that. And more so than in previous generations, Nintendo's thought process may be more in line with what we would see from third parties.
But don't people already start over in games like Call of Duty and stuff like that? Like these
Hold on. Those are different games. Like you can say
I know, but I kind of hate the idea. Am I the only one who hates the idea of just getting the same game but with quote unquote more content? Like to
I haven't said my piece yet, Guillaume. So
I would assume there's plenty of people that feel that way, but then there's also people that feel I think a launch has to cater to, if you're hoping to reach out to a decent amount of consumers, you need to have content that reaches your people with different preferences.
So Guillaume, you have somebody who agrees with you in this argument. I just want to make sure you aren't falsely equivocating two things. Those games are new and distinct games, and you and I aren't big shooter fans. We may not appreciate the distinction, the fine distinction in the multiplayer between the different Call of Duties as they come out, but people who play those games do perceive distinct differences.
Sure, and they add new things, and might have jetpacks and stuff like that, but it's essentially kind of the same controls and the same types of loadouts. Like, people who are going from one game to the next kind of know what to expect.
They're a sequel, yes. Yeah. I think equivocating a sequel with an upport is not fair.
Let me start over. Like, this idea that, okay, let's take these games and all their content and port them over and add more content. I at this point, why not just keep playing the same old game? And while you're waiting for a more substantial upgrade, i.e. a sequel.
I think one thing I would say specifically on the Smash Brothers point is that they come out so rarely. That is one of the few real event type of things when it comes, because it is 5 or 6 years between them, that I think people might be more willing to say, if this is, just kind of a way to, freshen up Smash Brothers a bit, within a couple of years rather than six, then, they might be more involved. Whereas like Mario Kart, because it's been split between portable and console, you've had one every 2 years.
It's been a little while now.
A little while now, but by the time the NX come out, it will be a little while, but you're still talking about 3 years, 2 years, as opposed to six or so. That is a long time, especially in the life of young people who are, still one of Nintendo's biggest constituencies.
So I'm playing devil's advocate for both positions right now, so you're going to have to deal with that. So what I'm saying may not represent my personal opinion. I'll talk about that in a minute. So the argument for doing this, speaking to Guillaume's question of why not just wait for a proper sequel, and I totally get that position.
Well, I think a lot of people would, but some people wouldn't. I mean, that's just the market.
Most people who play video games didn't own a Wii U.
Exactly.
That's why you would do it. Now, they're not necessarily targeting us on this call, because we already own – I own every game in that list. I imagine all of us own every game on that list. We're not the target for this, although we may double dip.
I think there's a subset of people like us that are the target.
Who will double dip?
I mean,
I mean us in this conversation. There's a couple games here that I think would get double dipped on by this group, but I don't think any of us are going to go out and buy Mario Kart for NX if it's the same game.
What I'm hoping they're doing is, like I said, something that's more akin to they're. Maybe they don't even remake it at all. They recompile it.
I get that. Totally.
Quote unquote free. It says you already own this. Instead of having to do this dumb Wii mode in your Wii U, it's just a game.
The only challenge there
or,
who bought
or it's,
it
you know, a negligible fee where they can, can help subsidize the cost of that transfer. So it's
sure.
$60 for anyone who didn't own a Wii U. This is a brand new opportunity to own the game. And for everyone like us, $10. Okay, great. Yeah, I'll pay $10 so that I can play it on the new system. Fine.
I think GX is speaking in terms also of these sort of like, here is Smash Brothers with all the DLC already included, go. And getting closer to my personal feelings on the, I wouldn't be offended if these games came out. Like, it wouldn't offend my sensibilities. I understand the business case for doing it.
I suppose the other component of it is that the feeling that games like Mario Maker and Splatoon feel like they've got, you know, came out more recently than Smash Bros.
Right.
And Mario Kart. Yeah, they feel like they've got legs in them, but the Wii U doesn't. You know, so I think that's the other point. If you like those games, you don't like the idea of them sort of being killed off before their time by the fact that the Wii U cycle is a bit sad. So I think that that is also something that people would hope for. I think that just it would be a way that these games wouldn't be kind of cut off in their prime.
And I get that. But, you know, from my perspective, I agree with Guillaume in that I want to see... Like Mario Kart.
The thing is, when you've got a certain engine, you've got a certain. You built the game a certain way, and after that, it's kind of harder to make that engine, make that game do things that were not expected of it, right? Like,
it depends on the engine. I mean,
yeah, sure, but in a certain way, like in many cases, you're going to kind of be shackled by this engine that you created, and so adding more content is not really going to solve much.
Adding more content is explicitly solving the limit of the engine. You're saying we're going to add more things that fit within the parameters of what this game can do. I mean, you are explicitly addressing that concern by going, well, let's not deal with it. Let's just make more stuff this thing can handle.
Right.
That imposes creative limitations.
It does. But I mean, ultimately, how much of a creative limitation do you think there is stuck in Mario Kart, whatever number this should actually be versus whatever number it is, that unless they're going to do a fundamental rethink of what is Mario Kart?
I think that Nintendo would have had a harder time putting in F-Zero levels in Mario Kart 7 or Mario Kart Wii than they did in Mario Kart 8. Mario Kart 8.
Yeah, and then if you apply that forward.
Well, no,
you know,
I get that, but my point is, like, I
certainly wouldn't want this to be at the expense of you know, newer things, but you know, you'd want it in tandem with original content designed around the new platform. I think the primary issue for a lot of people is just that these games, you know, could have a really long life, and they want to see them continue to exist.
Right.
And the fear is that the Wii U is going to get kind of taken out the back and shot shortly after the NX emerges.
If NX really is a combination mobile and console platform in Japan, that's an opportunity to sell that game to people that just play mobile.
No, that's exactly what I was talking about last week when I spoke about Splatoon, that it's done incredibly well in the small pond of Wii U, but you do have to wonder what it could do if it played in that far bigger
I still
space.
Think
and again, you don't need to release a new game if depending on how they're moving forward, it's the same game. It's just now we can run on. Saying you wouldn't build a new game. I don't want them to just rely on their evergreen titles forever. I mean, that's what got Nintendo into their current ditch with Wii, is that you can just keep selling the same game. But for a launch period and to reach a new audience, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with having that out the gate, plus a brand new Mario game or whatever, one or two key new games that the developer's been working on. Fleshed out with these other games that a lot of people
I do believe that we are poised to see, you know, certain sort of substantial amount of original content, because if you noticed, you know, last year a lot of the stuff that Nintendo revealed that we didn't already know about was very repurpose-ish, so to speak. You know,
we have a comment on that later.
You look at stuff like Triforce Heroes, for instance, which kind of took the basics or bones of Link Between Worlds and then turned it into a multiplayer game. And some of these Paper Jam Brothers, of course, is already with us in Europe, and will be with America shortly, and it's already out in Japan. You know, it's taking that lovely sprite work that they already did for Dream Team and bringing it back and putting some Paper Mario assets in. You know, there's a lot of feel of like, okay, we're squeezing what we can out of stuff we've already done while the new work goes on in the background.
Here's the concern I have, and this with this topic in particular, and with whatever the hell NX is, because we don't know, and anytime we say we're speculating, but things like adapting Splatoon and Mario Maker in particular to a device to which they were not designed is going to be a challenge, and I want, if Nintendo is going to do that, if they're going to move those to whatever NX is, I want them to spend a tremendous amount of time making sure that it feels just as good. Because to me, the tilt controls in Splatoon are really, really good.
I certainly would not want to do without them.
I use them in conjunction with the thumbsticks, and like that gives me a sense of fidelity over what I'm doing that I don't have otherwise. Mm-hmm. And the ability to rapid jump in there is so vitally important to me and how I play that game that like, and having that map right there, even though I don't look at it all that often, like all that stuff matters. And it matters because somebody had a Wii U in their hands when they were making that game. With Mario Maker, obviously, it is part and parcel with what Mario Maker is.
In the making levels, you could have kind of a WarioWare DIY type of like app, you know,
yeah,
like,
but,
playing the game, playing
people's
levels.
You could also ship Super Mario Maker NX with a kind of a mouse peripheral, you know, gray and purple.
Well, if for America, it'd be, you know, presumably be other colors.
People throw this out there, and I want them to really think about the implications of putting these games.
No,
on
I mean it would be more like it would. It could be more substantially sort of, you know, taxing on development resources than you might think.
Right.
But it may also still be worth doing. I mean, the problem is obviously we're dealing with so many variables in terms of exactly what form the system will take and how much continuity there can be in terms of, you know, your purchase history, your save files, all this stuff. It's very difficult to really project forward and say, is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Exactly.
You know, I think it's certainly conceivable that it could turn out to be a very good thing, but that's far from proven.
All right, so we have the next email. I believe, Greg, you are our next email reader.
Yes. Dear darling gentlemen, on the last episode, you mentioned the possibility of a Lady Tingle game making its way to the US. I would like to quickly note that if female Link is named Linkle, then surely female Tingle will be named Tinkle. Heaven help if you read this on the podcast. Let it be read by Greg's sophisticated persona, Adieu, Mr. Finkel. And just briefly, I should say to Mr. Finkel that my sophisticated persona was unavailable because it's booked on the after dinner speaking circuit. So you just got the regular me. Also, is that an Ace Ventura reference? Einhorn is Finkel. Possibly. I should issue a mea culpa here. I was conflating my Tingle games when I referenced this last week because the Pink Lady Tingle is actually in Rosie Rupeeland that was localized for Europe.
Yes.
Right.
And her name was Pinkle.
It sure is.
So there you go. Yeah, James actually played that game.
I did play that game.
It, yeah.
I didn't figure the correction was necessary because at that point, like, I was going to go with the joke.
I don't know whether she also appears in the Balloon Trip of Love game that only came to Japan.
Well, I think... She is the target of his affection, so probably.
Wow. But, so, you know, they were thinking along the same lines there. But I do think that game should come to America. You know, this should be the time that some of these DS games that were, you know, local, it goes both ways. Yeah, there were games that came to America that didn't come to us, and vice versa. You know, you think of Last Window as well as Tingle and stuff like that. You know, like, why not on the DS Virtual Console? We've seen it with other stuff like various types of import games. Like, we just got quite a number of that kind of thing over here, you know, over the past few months. You know, some really fun games that never came out in Europe before, like Drill Dozer for the GBA.
Yeah, did Drill Dozer. We can't even get, like, anything.
Well,
at
we
all.
Didn't get it, but we didn't get it on GBA, so it's kind of, like, fair play.
I want to point at this point, NOA is so bad at releasing Virtual Console games, they haven't even released games that NOE forgot existed. Like, that's the depths of their failure.
No, so I mean, I think all that kind of stuff should get flip. Like, we should get Chibi Robo Park Patrol. We never, you know, that was a Walmart exclusive in the States, so it's probably a good candidate to come out in America as well. But it never came out at all here. So Tingle, you know, that way Pinkle could emerge into the American culture.
That
finally.
Game is such such a freaking mind trip. Like, I don't even understand. Like, I played it for a while, and its gameplay mechanics are paper thin and also completely inscrutable. It's the strangest combination of emotions I've had playing a game in a long time.
And I kind of wonder.
None of them are good emotions.
Kind of wonder if they had planned a third game where you play as Tingle's grandma, Wrinkle.
On that.
Yeah.
Because it was a fairly short email, Greg, why don't you go ahead and read the next one too?
Okay, Lolmanade writes, Dear RFN, I miss getting an instruction booklet with my games. It was great to have a physical document that contained a summary of the story, game controls, and even some of the best strategies for using those controls sometimes. They even came with a note section to write down important things. It provided me with an opportunity to sit down and acquaint myself with my purchase as a child before I got the chance to play. Some publishers went above and beyond the bare minimum, providing neat extras. A copy of Ultima 4 I had came with a cloth map of the game world, or baking secrets needed for the game inside them, such as Star Tropics. Do any of you miss instruction manuals or have interesting examples of ones that affected the game experience? Do you think anything has been lost in the age of digital manuals and in-game tutorials?
Well, sure, because now instructions that used to come in the manual and that you could ignore until you needed them are now in the game and usually in tutorials that you cannot skip. So it's had, I think, a very direct effect on game playability. You know, like nowadays, games assume you're not going to pick up a manual, so they don't even include one, and they put all the info and they force you to go through it. So
it's kind of ironic in a way, though, because now you have digital manuals which you know you're going to be able to access. You didn't, you know, it's not hidden under the bed, or, you know, it's gone missing, it's in the bin, or you've got it secondhand and you didn't get the manual with it. Like, you know, so like the manual could be leaned on more than it used to, hypothetically.
Xenoblade, Chronicles X.
You know what?
I was fine with that, though. I was quite happy with that.
A lot to talk about in that game. So I think actually it may have undersold some parts. Like, there's stuff in there, like, they're like on flash screens, like, hey, you should probably read the manual, but don't worry about it. It's fine. Like, okay. Like, I will say actually, Xenoblade Chronicles is one of the best arguments for digital manual I've seen, because there's so much stuff in that manual and it's sorted kind of nicely. You couldn't put that in a print manual. Like, it would be.
Could you not?
I have trouble finding the content I'm looking for in that manual.
Yeah, me too.
I really haven't had any issue with it. Like, there's an index. I jump to where I want to go. I'm there. I read it. I got my mount.
I remember spending like 10 minutes trying to find the section that talks about skeletal insurance or something, or exactly what happens with what. Maybe it wasn't that example, but there have been a couple of times where I'm like, I know.
Right,
I guess whenever it gets that big, it's going to be a bit of a problem.
But the thing that most kind of bums me out about the loss of the physical manual is that there is something about the opportunity that the publisher had to kind of be expressive in that space. You know, some of the best manuals are maybe not the best at being manuals. They're just kind of interesting or unique in some way or another. I'm blanking on what game.
The Donkey Kong Country series, I remember loving reading through the manuals. Like, almost every page would have some snarky comment from Cranky Kong.
There's a manual. Yeah.
And other times, you know, it's just nice artwork, right? I think Mario Brothers 3 had really nice artwork in its manual. I remember
my experience of manuals is probably rather different from yours, because I spent so many of the games I played in my childhood were Japanese.
Right.
And of course, I had no way to comprehend it. So I still used to look through the manuals for the artwork, really, you know, to kind of see. And that is a lot of the time the only way you'd kind of get the promotional artwork. You know, you wouldn't see it on the internet anything. Right. You know, I didn't have access to the internet, but I had to play Super Famicom games, so it was nice in that way, but it couldn't really explain anything to me, so I didn't really have that much use for manuals. And then even that kind of crept in even when I started getting more English language imports towards the back end of the Super NES era, and then like into N64. But I did always like those N64, like the thing around the manual in Japan was like a card, a plastic card that just had the controls on it, which is kind of what you got to when people were really cutting down on manuals years later, where it was just like a one-sheet thing with the controls on. Whereas with Japanese N64 manuals, they had like the controls wrapped around the main body of the manual, and then, you know, it was more orthodox inside, which was kind of cool, because it just made the really important things obvious to me as someone who didn't understand Japanese.
Yeah, I would say that the coolest manual, and I'm blanking on what game it was, but there was a game where the manual was written entirely as like the travel logs of the people, of one of the characters in the game. So it was kind of riddled
with... Could it be Illusion of Gaia, or...?
Nah, I didn't play Illusion of Gaia until later. I'm blanking on what it is, because it was written by a character whose basic job is to just kind of be, you know, in the background, being sort of a jerk to everybody. And there's, like, weird commentary on the game, like, just in the manual, just completely disconnected from anything. And I just remember reading going, like, what the hell? And then when I played the game, there were these... Turns out the manual was full of these weird in-jokes that when I got to that point again, went like, oh, that's pretty funny. But at the same time, you know, I say that, but I can't... I didn't read manuals a whole lot as a kid. Like, you know, I remember reading Smash Brothers in the car going home because I was so excited to play that game. And I remember reading Ogre Battles because the game is so inscrutable on its own. Yeah. But it actually, that actually doesn't tell you any of the stuff. Like, that game's all about just figure it out. Figure it out. So... There is, you know, I can sit here and tell you that I'm going to be wistful for their loss, and I certainly notice it every time I open a game, but at the same time, like, you know, I can't sit here and talk about how my deep, unabiding love of just reading manuals stuff, because obviously I didn't have that as a kid, you know, it was just like, I'm going to rip through it. I think Guillaume's point, and I hadn't really considered it, is probably the most important here, that the lack of manuals may also be because they've shifted some of this stuff into the game itself, which makes me really want to like melt Fi down and use it to make anything else but a sword, because goddamn it, shut up.
Yeah, and not just like the controls, but also the story, the setup. It used to be
write that into all this weird stuff about how the blocks in Mario were like people or whatever. I mean, just like all this weird sort of exposition and all that you know, just couldn't really be communicated through games at that point. You know, obviously NES games eventually got to that point of like Ninja Gaiden or something, you know, like told a bit of a story or, you know, but certainly at that stage it wasn't. They were far too kind of arcade influenced to kind of really go into anything like that.
Right. Digital manuals, by and large, are much more sterile.
I don't think they have to be that way. I mean, even like the digital manual with Mario Maker actually has personality.
You're right. That is a good counterexample.
So it's not as if they have to be. It just seems like they are. You know, like it just, and again, I think that's a lot now because the assumption is that, you know, the critical information is going to be contained in the game itself. So it's just this very kind of bare bones, explicit spelling things out place. That's all the manual is. It's not really for added flavor or color or anything
right.
like that.
It used to be that Wario in the Wario Land, you know, manual would talk to you and, you know, interject and like, oh, garlic, I just love that stuff. And,
yeah, it's very, very similar to the Donkey Kong Country type.
And I did like some of the extras you would get, like the map I had the North American Link to the Past. So I had the map of Hyrule as well as the manual. And that was cool because it just kind of, especially I think, you know, the whole waiting to play angle that is spoken about. Right. In the email, you know, that is something I had a lot of as a younger person, because, you know, it's hooked up to the family TV and, you know, people are wanting to watch stuff and what, you know, so you kind of in that headspace of like, I'm thinking about a game but I can't play it. It was really quite cool. Obviously once you're older and you're playing handhelds or off-screen Wii U TV, you know, all that kind of stuff, it doesn't really enter into the equation so much, but so I guess younger kids these days probably just have their own screen for stuff a lot of the time, but it still must be something of a loss in that regard.
I guess
you could just look stuff up on the internet now. You could read salty message boards.
Your favorite game has a wiki.
Wasn't there one of the Wario Land games or something where just in the middle of the booklet there's like, okay, here's a little maze puzzle for you to fill out now.
I can believe it.
I can't remember that, but one that stuck out with me was the Uniracers manual, where there's a page where it says, like, hey, have you ever read a manual where it says, like, this page intentionally left blank, and, well, oh, we don't do that, and then they go on to talk about pizza, and, you know, it's not that funny.
Irreverence.
But as a kid, I found it pretty funny.
So, Guillaume.
Yes.
You have the next email.
Sure. So, Luke writes, hi, guys. In recent weeks, you have spoken about Yoshi's Woolly World and Chibi-Robo's Ziplash. I finished Woolly World earlier this year, and I'm currently a bit over halfway through Chibi-Robo. After the first few stages, I was thinking, This game really feels like it could be a Yoshi game. Both have similar level structure, secrets, hidden items, and collectibles. Chibi-Robo's Zip Lash also works a lot like Yoshi's Eggs, the way he uses it as a weapon and how it rebounds off walls. What are your thoughts on this? Is it a coincidence, or were Skip talking to Goodfeel on how to make a good platformer?
So I have only played Yoshi's Woolly World, so I can't speak to Chibi-Robo Zip Lash. I would say, you know, I'm going to get my ignorant of the situation opinion out of here and say that it's probably not a coincidence, but it's probably also not communication. It's probably people who were making Chibi-Robo and people who were playing Skip played a lot of the same games.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a there's certain templates that have been laid down by all of these many side-scrollers that we've started to see, really, since sort of New Super Mario Brothers got the ball rolling more than 10 years ago now. But certainly it's best sort of accelerated, especially after kind of New Super Mario Brothers Wii. And, you know, we've got a lot, and it's kind of codified certain elements, you know, and you see them across a lot of different things, you know. There's star coins in a new Super Mario Brothers game, or Kong letters in a Donkey Kong game, or obviously they all have their own different sort of riffs on it and whatnot, but, you know, I think it goes beyond just, you know, Chibi-Robo and Yoshi, but you could see like, more commonalities across things. I mean, well, I think that I detected a fair bit of, actually a bit of DKC, the two new ones in Chibi-Robo, because you've got those stages where you kind of go into a plug socket, kind of into a pipe or something, through a plug socket, and then it's a challenge to collect all the coins within a certain amount of time. That's very similar to the banana barrel type challenges that you would get in the DKC. In fact, it was better in one way, which says they explicitly indicated if you had found and cleared that in a previous playthrough of the level, which, as far as I know, DKC games do not. I always found that annoying, where it's like, oh, I found this barrel. Have I been in here before? Oh, I better do it just in case. And then you do the challenge and, oh, look, the jigsaw piece is transparent because I have collected this before. Right. Oh, thank you very much. Whereas, you know, they avoided that in Chibi-Robo. So, you know, they kind of improved on that a little bit. And Tanabe oversaw Chibi-Robo in some capacity, didn't he?
He did. Yes.
So there is a very direct in terms of the communication issue. I mean, you wouldn't even really need communication there because the same man overseeing, those two games. But I'm sure you think there's a lot of that kind of stuff that happens in a more tacit fashion as well.
I would say both these games definitely have inspiration. Well, I mean, in one case it's not inspiration; it's straight up descent of. But both of these games have, at least from what I've seen, some Yoshi Island in them.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say, the difference with the Zip Lash mechanic specifically, of course, is that whereas you can fire off multiple eggs in short order, you know, with the Zip Lash, you've got to stand, you're rooted to the ground, you're charging it up, and then you fire, and it takes a while to extend a really long way and bounce off the walls or whatever it's got to do. So, you know, it's not as quick fire in that way.
So I haven't played the final Chibi-Robo game. But
you had to stick the knife in.
Yeah, let's be optimistic. I'm sure there's going to be more.
I haven't played the actual release of that game, but E3 this year. That is actually what I meant to say.
I see the worst in it.
Or less side by side, and I did go back and forth between the two, and I don't think I was the only one who noted on the show floor the similarities between the two games, but the Chibi-Robo game is much, I guess you'll call it more deliberate, or the pacing is pretty different.
Yeah, I think it is. Not that Yoshi is like breakneck pace or anything. It's certainly not like a, you know, a DKC where it's going to force you forward a hell of a lot or whatever. You know, I mean, you are largely kind of wandering around, exploring, finding everything. But as I said, in part because, especially if you're using the gyro controls with shooting the eggs, it could be really quick to just snap egg shots off and do what you want with that. Whereas Chibi-Robo is very deliberate. And in fact, they could have used some gyro for aiming in that. Because they did with the handheld Yoshi's New Island.
Right.
But they didn't. And
the fine example.
I guess some of
it's
just because the game is so deliberately paced anyway. They didn't really feel it was a big deal.
It does use the gyro for certain transformations, right?
Like, yeah. It's not as if it doesn't use it at all.
But it just for that core aiming of, you know, where you're going to fire the plug, it doesn't, which I found a little surprising given they have embraced that so much. And that's one area where, you know, it does not follow the Yoshi template.
Yeah, I just brush off the similarities to the same reason that, you know, like so many platformers have you jump on the enemies to kill them and stuff like that. It's just, it's kind of, there was, you know, many of the big hits of the genre were created by Nintendo, like Super Mario Brothers was super influential. So it kind of, everyone copied that and it kind of became what you did in that genre, right? So you look at, you look at Chibi Robo, he uses a whip. You could say, well, it's very similar to Yoshi's Island, but it's also very similar to Castlevania, you know, and like the way that you whip and kind of swing from the whip, like it's reminiscent of Castlevania 4,
you know,
Super Metroid.
I wouldn't have believed you until you killed Dracula as Chibi Robo. Then you had
Oh, that'd be brilliant. I'll tell you one
thing
I didn't mention.
Actually, there is a vampire enemy in Chibi Robo.
Well,
so.
Also, though, you get the costumes. I should have. The costumes you get in Chibi Robo are quite. Obviously, in Yoshi, you get all the amiibo costumes that like changes colors. But the costumes in Chibi Robo, which you get in a weird way, kind of random, but you get some great ones. The Explorer Chibi Robo, which is basically like Henry Hatsworth. That is how I see Chibi Robo now. I played the whole game with him like that, and I don't want to go back. That's who he is to me.
Oh, you're going to be a sucker for the Chibi Robo amiibo line.
I rather think that line might be quite short.
No.
This one has a new hat.
It unlocks everything the same, but you have to have it. I do have some concern, though, and I might be the only one here that, you know, I jokingly called 2016 the year of no, we need to stop making 2D platformers or something along those lines. And I'm concerned that Nintendo and their subsidiaries and partners, having gone so far up their own, backlog, as we use for it,
okay.
Making these games, these kind of, you know, reflexive games based on their older franchises that maybe they kind of become not repetitive, but that like the feedback loop gets too intense and these games.
That's why it's such an odd choice though to take something like Chibi Robo, which has not been in that vein, and then make it into it.
Yeah, but it was cheap. That was the reason.
I think they just wanted to. They like the Chibi Robo character, and they feel like, you know, they wanted to try it in a different kind of game, and this was a kind of game that they know how to oversee
easily.
And yes, it's presumably not terribly expensive or risky, but it doesn't seem to have yielded particularly productive results. But I certainly think, you know, I mean, I'm glad, you know, that the renaissance in 2D platforms is one of the favorite things that has happened over the past several years. You know, it has become a fairly sort of, you know, crowded space with all the franchises they've kind of brought back. That I don't think it was particularly apt to take something that didn't have that background and shunt it into it.
Well, and when they re-entered that space, you know, they sort of brought it back in sort of triumphantly. Like, it was kind of a space that had been left to what at the time was independent games, but that was a very different thing than it is now. It was much less, it was people making games on their own and just sort of pushing them out into the internet. Now you see these relatively big budget 2D platformers coming out of independent studios or coming out of Kickstarter. You see them being scammed and never released by Mighty No. 9's team. so like these games are coming out now from other vectors than just Nintendo. And I'm concerned that if they continue to produce these games and they don't fundamentally shift what they're doing, they're going to become looking very conservative. I mean, they already are, but they're going to become increasingly overly conservative to the point that even when compared to games built on a smaller budget by a smaller team with less experienced people, they just look very stale. And I wonder if maybe much like, you know, the refrain of Ubisoft needs to stop making Assassin's Creed for like 2 years. Like, if Nintendo and all its divisions need to go, all right, hard stop, no 2D platformers for 2 years, go. Because I worry.
Well, like I said, I think some of it, and the other part of it as well, is I love the DKC games, but I mean, I don't know whether that's Retro's area of comparative advantage. You know, it's because they know how to do other types of games. Well, I suppose that's debatable given all the departures.
They're good at car combat games, that's for sure.
Yes, the knowledge still resides within there. In terms of just like, you know, managing their resources to their best advantage, you know. Right. I'm not sure whether tasking Retro with 2D platforms when Nintendo themselves and Goodfeel and whoever else are all very, very good at making them already, was necessarily the most efficient use of their development resources. But obviously we don't know exactly what was going on with Retro at that point, with all those people leaving.
I think it's fine that Retro made two Donkey Kong games. I think they're really good. I think
I'm a big fan.
I don't think it was a waste of their resources like some Metroid fans will tell you. I think that's an absurdly ignorant statement. It's profoundly.
No, I certainly don't accept that.
No, I think that is a profoundly ignorant thing to say. Those are tremendously good games. Like they are some of the best examples of 2D platforming I have seen in my life. Like to call those games a waste of resources is just profoundly ignorant, because they are tremendous titles. However, I don't need to see Nintendo continue to iterate on the 2D platformer. I feel like it's a diminishing returns thing. I feel like this is a situation where you take a step away and you say, okay, if we have something that fundamentally changes up what these are, let's do it. But otherwise, let's not. And I think what worried me a little bit about 2D Land, less so in 2D World, is how...
I am 2D Land?
3D Land, I'm sorry.
3D Land, 2D Land,
you know, whatever.
It's a crucial distinction.
It's not a crucial distinction because the joke I was getting ready to make, so it's fine. Is that, like, it showed this kind of, like, well, our this is what people like, so let's make our 3D games closer to that. And I don't want that personally, but at the same time, I'm not super fretting it. It's just, I want them to continue to experiment, and I don't know how much room to experiment they have left in these 2D games.
Yeah, well, it is interesting. Obviously, the Super Mario Brothers games have still sold very well in general. Wii U was, you know, limited by, you know, the Wii U, you know, the start that it had, the poor start, but like, I think, New Super Mario Bros. 2 sold over 2 million copies in Japan alone. You know, so I doubt we're going to stop getting those as the flagship. And they tend to be the most conservative of all.
New Super Mario Bros. 2 is probably the least conservative only because it's trolling its own formula. Like,
and also because I think it was just conceived in haste.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was made in an early version of Super Mario Maker. In fact,
all right,
just
now,
seems like it's that kind of level.
It's a little bit like Kaizo Mario bullshit in that game. Like
it was a time when they was really struggling for software on the 3DS. They felt like the 3DS had, you know, was at this junction point, you know, this turning point where they might not ever perform as well as it does if they don't get games on it now when they, you know, they put it out there. So it's not their finest hour. I mean, I still enjoyed it, but you know, it's you know, not the kind of thing I'd like to see them sort of do endlessly. But I don't think there's too much risk of that unless things really go awry. You know, because I mean, Luigi U I thought was great. That was a really cool way of kind of putting a twist on the game they already had and making the level short and kind of crazy. And that was awesome. So I still think it's fertile ground here. It's just you've got to balance it.
I think they are going to step away some from it. I think they realize that. And I think in some sense, the Mario Maker release is sort of signaling that, you know, maybe they're going to just ride that out for longer. They're not going to step away entirely from 2D platforming, James.
I think it's
like
time.
You were going to get another 2D Kirby game at some point, whenever they actually.
No, well, they've got Kirby on track again, and those games have performed well. I mean, I've seen no reason why they should change that now.
Because imagine a first-person 3D Kirby. That's why they should change it.
The thing is, Kirby will always be in weird stuff too. That's the thing. Yeah. I mean, he'll get all sorts of games, but they've got core Kirby sort of on track as well. No, I mean, I also think to kind of go back to the prediction I had about a Galaxy 3, well, John had as well, about Galaxy 3 Tokyo. I think, I mean, I really, really like 3D Land and 3D World, but I don't really think you could go further in that direction. You know, I mean, because then you are just getting to the 2D games, you know? So, yeah, they've done two really good games in that style. I think now might be the time to differentiate the 3D games a bit more again. And so, you know, that might kind of alleviate it somewhat, the fatigue to the extent that it might exist.
I think we can get a 2D version of Luigi's Mansion.
Oh. All right, this is our last email. Justin writes, "Hey guys, great best of the 2015 show, but I like my RFN with a little more cynicism." Great. "What do you think was the biggest disappointment of 2015? And just so we don't get too negative, what about the biggest surprise? Biggest disappointment for him would probably be the lackluster Mario Tennis, and his biggest surprise is obviously Cloud and Smash." All right, who wants to go on their disappointment?
I assume we're talking about like game releases.
It could be. It's news. Totally up to you. Up to you. Up to you.
I need some time to think about this. Sorry. I interjected.
Well, I mean, just to speak to his things, I mean, Mario Tennis was somewhat disappointing because I do like Camelot sports games a lot, and it would have been very nice for a really good Mario Tennis game to appear on Wii U. However, you know, the way it was unveiled,
we had warning.
The way that it wasn't talked about after that at all, it did not come as a great disappointment. You know, the way things unfolded, it just, you know, the expectations were low, and then they kind of, you know, hit around that area. So I guess that's a kind of a semantics point. But
I actually played the demo, so yeah, this isn't.
So there's that. Cloud, you know, was certainly a surprise in some senses, although, like I said, he was always the kind of play, the character you'd think they'd want to make happen because so many people recognize him, and it's, you know, you kind of get another major constituency.
But it was fairly dopey that they couldn't get him in the PlayStation All-Stars game, and suddenly he's in the
Smash. But it's like, would it happen? It's just like, could they make it happen?
Right.
You know, would they want him? Sure. Would he be high on the ballot? Sure. Would they get him? That seemed like all of the questions. So it was something of a surprise that he got in. For me, I think, I mean, disappointment. It was somewhat of a disappointment that Star Fox got kicked out of the year. Although it wasn't a shock. Again, you could argue it's kind of what you expected, but it's just, you know, I've been looking forward to Star Fox, a new Star Fox, for a long time. So the thought of it coming out at Christmas was really cool, but it didn't happen. So that was something of a disappointment.
So I guess my biggest disappointment, I almost don't want to say it. So when I was playing Xenoblade Chronicles on the Wii, I was hoping that the Monolith's next game would be more streamlined and have less bullshit and have more better menus and better direction.
Were you hoping it had smaller text?
No, I was not.
Well, guess what, Guillaume? Here it is anyway.
So yeah, my biggest disappointment is that I was hope that the stuff that I was hoping would go away in Xenoblade Chronicles X is back with vengeance. You know, like these quests where you have to collect like 14 of these things, and these things are just random things that you can't really identify on the field, and you just pick up, and once you pick them up, okay, so it's a I don't know, like a happy squirrel or whatever, and you collect 14 of them, and it's like, what's the point? It's just time wasting bullshit. And like the menus, I don't know how they got worse, you know, like now it's harder to see who you have built an affinity with, you know. It's just everything is more cumbersome. The weapon customization seems to have gotten worse, like because you've got so many in your menus, so many different.
They built it out so much more.
But they haven't really put in ways for you to kind of manage that stuff. So you're kind of having to deal with scrolling down 400 different types of guns to find the one that's not too bad, and then you try to improve that one with augments or whatever.
Or you ignore that because you're mean, you don't want to deal with that stuff at all.
Yeah, that's mainly been the route that I've been taking. So it's funny because I actually liked the side quest stuff in Xenoblade Chronicles. I did it because I thought it was fun. And in this case, even though it is more the main game than it was in the first, than in the Wii game, I'm just not enjoying it as much. Like, the focus is more on the side quests, but I think they've gotten worse.
Can I just take Yom's answer?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
I think I agree with everything you just said, Yom. I mean, I'm not really a side quest kind of guy when I play Zelda or RPGs. If I really like it, I'll deal with some of that post, you know, end credits. And this is sort of the antithesis of this, where I'm kind of forced to play through stuff I don't care about. And I think I agree. I think my biggest disappointment is Xenoblade Chronicles X. Not saying I totally hate the game. I think there's a lot to like about it, and I certainly enjoy parts of it. But the disappointment started when I was hearing Seren talk about the game. The Japanese release, and I don't know if I'm going to like this game. There's a reason I bought the physical copy of this game.
Yeah.
I'll say that. I don't buy many physical copies of games. I hedge my bets.
Yeah, and of course, biggest disappointment doesn't mean worst, right? Like, it's the biggest disappointment because the expectations were high.
Yeah, you built up some kind of expectation, which is my point about why I wouldn't necessarily put Mario Tennis in that category.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
Because they were, it'd be like saying your biggest disappointment is like Devil's Third. It's like, well, were you alive at any point during Devil's Third's conversations?
Yeah.
Or did you die and then come back and not realize what this game was? So for me, my biggest disappointment is Capcom's failure to localize Daigakuten Saibon.
That is terrible. That is really disappointing.
Or to let Nintendo just do it. Just do what they did.
Because they're doing like six. They are doing six. It obviously rubs it in. I mean, that's a good thing in general, but it kind of rubs it in more because I was really interested in the period setting and Sherlock Holmes and all that stuff.
And like, just here's the thing. It's written by Shu Takumi himself, which is to me like the most important. The important thing there is, because you know the thing about the ones being written by the B team. I know that sounds offensive, but the ones being written by the sustainer team, Takumi's non team, is they're deathly afraid of moving along any of the character development because they don't own these characters. They don't want to screw it up. So they leave them basically where they are, or they introduce a new character so they don't have to progress anybody else. Whereas Takumi doesn't care. I'll go nuts. I'll kill somebody. It doesn't matter. Let's go crazy. You know what? Aliens. Done. Space aliens traveling through time. Done. Finished. Script's over. Oh, actually, it was a guy in a mask. He did travel time, though. Don't worry about it. I wanted this game so bad because, A, it's a period of Japanese history that's kind of insane when you think about how much a country can change in just a tiny window of time. And you felt like he was probably going to do that justice while also being a crazy person. And Layton versus Wright had some of the most asinine writing I've ever seen in my life. And I adored it for that. And what frustrates me to no end is Nintendo localized that game because Capcom and Level 5 are both like, I don't know if I want to handle this one. And Capcom and Level 5 said, okay, Nintendo, you can handle it. Why? It seems like Nintendo would take this game on if only to give the 3DS something with legs, something of a prestige title. So
they're too busy working the Dragon Quest.
Yeah, so instead Capcom is busy releasing this game as an anime after complaining it didn't sell well enough. What is wrong with you? You stupid company. God.
Make games.
I can't talk about Capcom because I just get upset. Like, there's no company I love more and also want to see terrible things happen to than Capcom. Because it's, the most frustrating company in the world. All right. So, biggest surprise. I actually know mine going in. So I'm actually willing to let that happen right now. And my biggest surprise was just how deep and dark the hole got when I got into Xenoblade Chronicles X. And I say that. Because I'm not the kind of person who goes and gets into Monster Hunter stuff. I've tried a bunch of times. And once you put a robot in front of it, like, the problems become manifest. Like, I ended up just, like, I just like having that feeling of, like, I built this and now it's going to wreck house. It's not about, like, the idea of just, you know, I'm gonna be really good in the combat system. It's, to me, the appeal was, hey, how much can I turn this into a one-shot machine where I'll just walk around the ground and kill everything in one blast? It's kind of that same weird appeal I have when I talk about spending hours on the unit building screen of Ogre Battle. Like, I've got this like, if I tweak this one thing, I've now turned it into the destroyer of worlds. And then, like, seeing it happen is great, but building it and that anticipation of, okay, I've got this thing, what's it gonna do? And then when it happens, just that awesome feeling of like, I did that to you, although you don't get to appreciate it because I turned you into vapor. That was awesome. And it's such a tiny portion of what that game is. Like, I was worried when I heard, it's a pretty light story. But, like, all this other stuff, like, I'm happy with it. Like, so I get the division here. But this would be, like, if we had Johnny on and we had worst game of the decade and I was like, it's Metro Prime. Echoes. you're a fan of the worst game ever, Johnny. Like, to me, this game does so much, makes me enjoy stuff that I didn't enjoy in other games that do it. And I was surprised. Like, I thought, like, all right, I'm going to mainline the quest and get out of there. And then I spent 4 hours in the field one day doing nothing, just wandering. And I was like, okay. And I looked up and went, oh, the whole day's gone. Oops. Well, it's my vacation. I'll do what I want. All right. Whoever wants to go next.
I'll go next. It's kind of, in some cases, similar reasons. My biggest surprise is how much I enjoy making levels in Mario Maker. And we talked about it some earlier, but I remember at both E3s having just no interest in this Maker tool. Like, I can't think of any other, you know, build your own level, build your own thing that I've ever really gotten into. And just something about Mario Maker, whether it's because I love Mario games, it's part of it, but just how well it all comes together. It's a real joy to just play with the Maker, whether you're goofing off or you're making something really serious. And I just, if you had told me, yeah, you're going to enjoy making levels way more than playing them, I would have thought you were insane if you told me that during either of the E3 showings. But that's the way it worked out. So to me, that's a huge surprise.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess Bucksboy is surprising just because you think last generation how Nintendo seemed to be not interested in making downloadable games themselves, and now they're having some of their best teams come up with content that could have been last generation released on, you know, a DS cart. And I'm just really happy to see this turnaround. It's the kind of downloadable content that I was hoping to see from Nintendo eventually, but I did not expect it to see such a constant stream, I don't know, Nintendo has been really good in the, you know, small downloadable game field, and they got good at it really, really quickly, and Bucksboy is just the latest illustration of that.
The resurrection of HAL?
Yeah, because you don't really hear about them that much other than, you know, Smash Brothers and Kirby, and out of nowhere, they just come out with this awesome little puzzle game. And now, like, even, like, stealth released this sequel to Bucksboy in Japan, and we're getting it soon. Like, it's just... I don't know what to say. It's surprising.
They're getting back to their low roots. Sorry, Eggerland roots.
Yeah. Well, if Nintendo really wanted to surprise me, they could release Adventure of Lodo 3 on a virtual console, but we'll see.
You said surprise, not miracles, Guillaume.
Yeah, I know.
Greg?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess in terms of like a positive surprise, which is, you know, what Justin's asking for, I think I was surprised how much I enjoy Codename Steam because... I said it had a while for the reviews to filter in and all that, and then, you know, the buzz wasn't exactly that great, and I'm not the biggest kind of player of strategy or tactical games in general, or, you know, this kind of stuff, so I've enjoyed some, obviously, but I wasn't particularly kind of... you know, banking on liking it at all. You know, I kind of, you know, to go back to what TYP said about, you know, I bought the physical copy. you know, because it's like, well, if it's if it doesn't work out, I'll just, you know, pull the ripcord and flip it if it really just doesn't feel like it's gonna do anything for me. But then I ended up playing through it multiple times. I mean, that's not something I expected at all. I really enjoyed it. But the one thing I'm surprised about just in general, which we haven't seen the full fruition of, is the fact that Nintendo's actually gonna have the multiple Fire Emblem games thing going on in the Western markets.
Yeah.
I was skeptical that they could follow through with that in America and Europe, but looks
sure
like they are. So we've yet to see if that's actually going to turn out
but they've already sold out all the copies of that multi-pack, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, obviously that's the kind of thing that happens a lot in Japan. You know, but I wonder whether it's the best way to capitalize on the sort of momentum that they built with Awakening from a commercial point of view.
I mean, I guess it depends on how different the games are, and I don't know if they're pretty vastly different.
I think in terms of content, you know, they kind of might justify it in a certain amount of way, but in terms of like messaging and sure. all that kind of stuff, I wonder whether it will be, you know, a good service for the series or not.
We'll yeah. see. I mean, it could turn out well, like Pokemon or like Oracle of Ages for Oracle of Seasons, where I don't know why it worked out well for Pokemon, but I can understand why it worked for Oracle of Zelda games, because those games were, you know, completely different.
Right,
like,
different games. Yeah.
Games, you know, using the same engine, but they're, you know, very different in terms of a level
design.
There's
supposed to be three of them, for God's sake.
Yeah, so, there was three at one point.
You know, it's maybe reductionist of me to say that strategy games like that are going to be more similar from one side to the other. Maybe just because I'm
yes.
not as big of a Fire Emblem fan or a strategy game fan, but like you said, it really comes down to, is there fundamental differences in the philosophy of the level design and the you know, difficulty level or what and whatnot?
Well, it does seem like, you know, you've got some pretty major differences in terms of, like, you can't do the kind of grinding outside of the key battles in the Conquest version. So,
right,
okay. You know, there's a bit of a different ethos there.
Yeah, it's maybe but, more traditional. Final
you might have thought that, you know, if you were going to consolidate it, that, you know, maybe the Birthright campaign would be the main one, and then that would be like DLC rather than, which it can be. It can
right.
be that way. But when you've got two different sort of but equal SKUs on the shelves, so to speak, at the same time, I just wonder how clearly all that's going to get through to people.
And a third DLC one,
I think creatively, I don't see any problem with it. It's just how much it kind of penetrates the awareness of people that,
right.
You know, I think Awakening did. I'm not saying it was this huge, you know, crossover hit, but, you know, it definitely, you know, penetrated into the sort of consciousness of the gaming public a bit beyond the you know, its base sort of constituency.
So I will say, go ahead.
They're in a funny spot, because if they just made it DLC, then you'd be accused of, well, you have day one DLC.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, this is the sort of thing that, you know, it's almost like, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Like,
yeah, exactly.
It's an opportunity. But hopefully, you know, just the scope of the content and the quality of it may just sort of filter through, you know, perhaps to people's understanding. But that can be a lot to ask. I don't know.
I think they'll probably have a sticker shock, too.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So one thing I thought about making this my surprise, and I kind of sighed on it because I know he wanted us to be kind of positive surprised. Mobile. And I don't really have anything to say beyond that, but like, legitimately, like, we were surprised. So, I mean, surprise!
True.
I mean, it felt like it'd be not appropriate to just not mention that was a surprise.
The reason I asked the question originally, wasn't there a death?
There
the
was, yeah,
year.
That's true, and the death
and
of
Mr. Wise too.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That was
kind of
a shock. Totally out of the wheelhouse what Justin was looking for.
Fair
presumably.
Enough. All right, but that's gonna have to do it for email and for the show. I want to thank Mike for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
It was. You can hear him on Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, which is a lot of fun. If you don't know what the show is, Mike, you got the condensed elevator description you use?
I don't have one in particular, but I can give it a shot. So you play, it's a trivia game. You listen to the podcast, and your job is to figure out what game we have selected based on musical selections. So it's kind of a name that tune kind of thing. It's a lot of fun because we, there's kind of the songs that are hints, and then we talk about the game and after we reveal what it is. So it's a lot of fun if you're a fan of game music, or you just like discussion on a mixture of recent and classic games. It's a fun show.
Excellent. And you can see that over on NintendoWorldReport.com. You aim for what, about one a month or so?
That's the aim. I haven't really been sticking to it, but yeah, the goal is once a month.
Okay, cool. And email, I told you to get the email address at the end, and here it is. It's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You can send us your questions or comments there. Also, we are gearing up for our next retroactive, and with the absolute gluttony of 3DS RPGs that are coming out in the next couple months, to the point of it just seems like somebody has fallen asleep at the Switch to turn these things off. We're looking for your anti-RPGs. What game can you recommend to us? Preferably something available for download right now on the virtual consoles, but if it's easily attainable, we can flex the rules a little bit. But what is your anti-RPG? What game least inspires the RPG experience to you right now? That's also interesting to talk about, preferably, because we actually have to talk about this game for at least an hour. So, you can send those.
Non-ninja spirit.
Bayou Billy.
That's right. You can send these to Tetris. You can send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, or you can send them to the RFN Twitter account. John might forward them to me. He might tell you about it.
At RFN podcast, yes.
Yes. Or he might just say he's going to play it naked. We don't know. That's the joy of having a social media director who has completely lost his mind. So, with that, we are done for the week. I want to thank you all for being here. Guillaume, what's our music for this week?
The music is a choice of Kleksioshi. Mermaid Waterfalls from Shantae Half Genie Hero, which is not yet released.
Excellent. I want to thank you all for being here, and that's it. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.